Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. Here, the result is always positive. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, we discuss the mysteries of the universe and the Earth itself. When we are done, you will never look at the stars or yourself the same again. Whether you are in a truck headed for the coast or in a car driving across the frosty desert tonight, or working in your garage on your favorite project, as you listen, you are about to learn more about where you came from, why you are here, and where you are going than you thought possible. In here, your potential is absolutely unlimited. If you enjoy our bumper music tonight, it's all brought to you by one very talented young man named Clayton and his band Cell Dweller. It is industrial and quite powerful. You can buy it, of course, at celldweller.com or by visiting our website at x2-radio.com. Also, next month, The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 2, 2012, and The Harvest of the End Times comes out. It goes to the printer tomorrow for processing. It came out to 409 pages and will be available everywhere. If you want to get your copy to add to Volume 1, you will be able to get it first at our website sometime next month. And you can always go to arcofmillionsofyears.com for the latest information. Next week on X Squared Radio, we will have on the program Dr. Stephen Greer, founder of the Disclosure Project. If you ever wanted to know the latest efforts toward getting the world's governments to divulge what they know about UFOs to the public, this is the source, DisclosureProject.com. Tonight on our program, we have a very special guest, my good friend, many years, Dr. Nick Begich, co-author of Angels Don't Play This Harp with Gene Manning, also author of Earth Rising, The Revolution, and Earth Rising 2, The Betrayal of Science, Society, and the Soul. He also has 4 DVDs out, 2 of which are full-length lectures on many of the subjects you will hear tonight. As you listen, you can, of course, visit his website, earthpulse.com, and pick up any of these items. He also has listed dozens of excellent music CDs and, I'm going to call them audio therapy CDs, which will help you out. And I highly recommend visiting his website. Now, the subjects you will hear tonight are true. I have to warn you, some of them may be shocking. Some of them may reveal a world of which you are currently unaware. We hope that in learning these things, you will become energized yourself to act on behalf of the planet and human decency. The metamorphosis of mankind is a subject that excites most people. Everyone realizes that we are going through a technological revolution about every 10 months now. As you know, if you've bought a computer or a digital camera in the last year, you don't know the half of it. The research into the newest bulk of new technologies being financed is mostly being funded by weapons designers. While the world is at war with terror, it sounds like a good idea. But we have never had a good reputation for laying down weapons or power once the war is over. There is a new and growing terror being built as we speak tonight that has more collateral damage in its path than you can imagine. Tonight, we will scratch the surface during the next 3 hours. If you are listening live, you can call in at toll-free 888-268-4313. I have to tell you, if you hear this program, I want you to call a friend and have them listen to the archive when they can. Your actions after hearing these things tonight will affect the universe more than you can dream. Please welcome Dr. Nick Bekich. How are you tonight?
I'm doing great. It's good to be with you, Brooks. It's been a while.
Well, you know, this world is small, and though we have not really worked together on any projects for about, what has it been, 8 years?
Yeah, actually it has. It's been,
I'm sorry, because when I hit 40, they shortened years to about 9 months.
Yeah, I think so, too.
And I think when I hit 50, it went off the charts. I think years now last just about a summertime, and they're gone.
Yeah, it seems that the time does pass faster.
You and I have both been through a tremendous amount in the last decade. It boggles my mind. I've read both your books, watched both your movies, and read everything I could find on your website, and I am amazed. I am humbled to the dust of the work that you have done in the last decade. And I know that you bear a tremendous burden yourself, and you had some personal losses because of it, not only friends, but also in associates.
Yeah, you know, that I think that's just the nature of life. You know, it's it's had, the last 10 years has been from my perspective, at least, the most productive 10 years of my life, and we've gotten a lot done, and at the same time, you know, had our share of good times and bad times through that decade. But at this point, it's been, really, I think, a well-traveled road in terms of getting information out, and we're now in a position where we can continue that, you know, into the foreseeable future. So we're pretty excited about all of that.
Well, I'm excited, too. And I have, you know, during the last 10 years, I've been a commercial scientist, commercial engineer, and I have concentrated more on raising my four kids than I have on being an activist. But I am so compelled by what I've learned in the last 24 months or so that I've gone through a life change. I've decided that my effect on the universe with what I can write and what I can say is more important than building new vehicles or solving technological problems for banks.
Well, you know, I think people get to a point, you know, where they start to ask that question. You know, for me, it was one of my younger kids was talking one day and asking me about creativity, and I said, you know, it's like changing channels on a TV set. You know, you can just switch it. And I was trying to illustrate it for him, you know. And about a couple weeks later, I was in a position with the Anchorage school system that was an interesting position. I was doing a lot, but it was boring as heck. and my son says, you know, why don't you just change channels? And I thought about that, and I thought, you know, that's really is it. You know, find the things that you really love doing. If you're doing those, I think things work remarkably better than you could ever plan. And I think the last 10 years from Sheila's and my perspective has certainly been that.
So where did this all begin with you? Where did the harp and sort of getting involved in trying to get civilian oversight on military projects, where did it begin for you?
Well, you know, science has always been of interest to me across a lot of disciplines, and then looking at politics in Alaska, which is part of my family background here, and looking at sort of the combination there, it seemed to me that projects, science in particular, wasn't getting the kind of translations it needed just to plain language so people could talk about sort of the concepts behind it. And it began with HAARP, actually, when we first, I read the first press accounting of HAARP was in an Australian journal, and quite frankly, I didn't believe what it said, but my nature is to look at things critically, so I went and looked up the sources they referenced, and it was on a project in Alaska, and although we're a big geographic area, we're relatively small in population, so you tend to know, you know, what's going on, at least anything of scale, and HAARP was getting very little press coverage. And that's kind of where that sort of started. Eventually, you know, it became apparent to me, really through the assistance of scientists. In fact, at one point, even I had you looking at a couple of ideas around HAARP. And we went to a lot of people with different disciplines and said, hey, what do you think of this project technically, and what are the consequences of its operation? And from that, we wrote the first articles, and then later, Angels Don't Play This HAARP.
And HARP is the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Project.
That's correct. And you know, we've carried that issue, and it's an issue that's been of important to Europeans. We've taken it into the European Parliament. We've taken it literally around the world to get attention to sort of not just HARP, but sort of this direction of military technologies that aren't getting the kind of public scrutiny or debate that we certainly think they deserve.
Sure, because it kind of is a reflection of or a product of military philosophy or weapons development philosophy that it probably goes back before the Cold War. We sort of had this, and I served a number of years in the Air Force myself, we have this kind of black mentality that
right.
I would go to Air Force Now meetings and they would ask everyone without a top secret meeting to leave, and we'd all have to show our ID, and then we could stay, and then they would give us a 3-hour briefing on all the latest defense for our particular missile base or different offensive things that we were working on. And then we'd read about it in the newspaper on Sunday.
Right.
So there was this, you know, a frustration that if you share things with the general public, or for that matter, with Congress, that there's this sort of a political conduit straight to the New York Times, and it compromises their defensive advantage over their enemies.
Right, and you know, to a certain extent, I think all of us, you know, can agree there are times when that's appropriate. The problem is the times tend to expand. You know, when you have secrecy and non-disclosure and lack of oversight, the boundaries seem to flux a lot more than they otherwise would. So things that maybe shouldn't be classified end up classified. And it's not so much the construction of these technologies. In other words, how do you build this stuff? I mean, that certainly we can see the merit in keeping those things classified. But the general concepts of what technologies can do, particularly if they're treading on the basic fundamental principles of a democratic republic that are expressed, you know, constitutionally and otherwise. And that's where...
Exactly. In other words, development without representation.
Yeah, and that's exactly it. If you've got technologies that are going to impact upon, you know, liberties and basic freedoms within the United States, or basic concepts of what is, you know, allowable and not allowable without any public discussion, I think that's a mistake. And I think that doesn't bode well in the long run. It's like these then get developed in back rooms that really don't reflect who most Americans are, regardless of political persuasion.
And even when they're developed in the front rooms, like, oh, I remember, I guess what maybe precipitated the ending of the Cold War was a project affectionately known as Star Wars.
Right.
And, right. You know, I think more artistic license was taken with the actual abilities of Star Wars in the public eye than the technology really could do.
Right. I think that's very true, at least at that time, although a lot of the, you know, technical issues that existed then, you know, have since been resolved. I mean, from stabilizing satellites to, you know, energizing low-orbiting space platforms, you know, a lot of different technologies have evolved. You know, that make, you know, some of those concepts viable again. And actually, you know, some of the things learned during that time, because a lot of money was spent, have been applied to new technologies, you know, that have evolved since.
Well, I guess the general public sense was, oh, these weapons are just defensive. It's a lot of rhetoric that it's going to destabilize the world community. We certainly have the right to protect ourselves, especially from what has been marketed to us as the threat of rogue missiles, that we really do not have a system that would protect the United States against somebody surfacing 200 miles off the coast of Virginia and taking a pot shot at command and control.
Yeah, that's you know, there are you know, probably a few risks that can't be easily guarded against, but the ones that are evolving, you know, forgetting missiles that, you know, at the optimum velocities on intercontinental ballistic missiles, you might reach on reentry somewhere around 30,000 miles an hour, but you're talking about weapons here that are operating using energy as the base, traveling at about 186,000 miles per second.
The speed of light. So how long does it take to cross around the planet at that speed?
Yeah, well, around the planet, you can do it about, about six times in a second. So
right.
With a little change left. And so here you are with concepts like preemptive warfare introduced by the Bush administration and speed of light weapon systems being evolved by not just the United States, but even our traditional adversaries. So when you start to think about the applications in warfare and what can happen within warfare, things change dramatically. When you start to think about technological societies that are based on communications and the flow of electrons through wires, things get disrupted by these new technologies in a way that can cripple Western economies and any system that's dependent upon electronics and software to run it.
Mm. Yes, science fiction writers can go crazy with this kind of technology. But, we talked a little bit about HAARP a couple of weeks ago for about 30 minutes.
Right,
and
right.
I think our listeners have already heard a lot about HAARP, but some of the other weapon systems that have been developed in the last decade and are really coming to fruition now because of computer speeds and because of the heightened defensive posture that we've had in this country since 2001. Help us... bring us up to speed on maybe the top three or four energy weapons that that we might discuss.
Well, the one that's gotten probably the most attention is the Humvee-mounted dish used for creating heating sensations on the surface of the skin, up to about the sensation of about 130 degrees for riot control purposes and so on, essentially using microwave energy for accomplishing that. What they really don't say, and I mean, when you think about that, first of all, I mean, the idea of using heating to break up a crowd or to control people's behavior was, we thought, at least given up several hundred years ago when they quit burning people at the stake. But I guess we're bringing it back with this kind of a technological twist for crowd control. The thing they didn't say is that by changing the frequency, pulse rate, or any number of other parameters regarding the energy coming off of that very same dish, you could affect the body much differently. There was actually a study done at the University of Utah for the Air Force on the dosimetry of radio frequency. It's the Radio Frequency Dosimetry Handbook, and it was used for determining what dosages of radio frequency energy would be necessary and in what form to affect liver, kidneys, heart, lungs, etc. So although the device has a story that certainly applies to its use, changing it very slightly or even driving that system with computer software, you could alter it to affect any number of the vital organs of the human body, as an example.
So
that would probably be the number one item out there.
I have flashes of Tiananmen Square in my mind right now. When you say crowd control, you're talking any kind of crowd, right? Maybe... peaceful protesters against a tyrant all the way to we're heading for City Hall to burn it down kind of crowd control.
Exactly. In fact, it's this is considered non-lethal technology. So, in the years that it was funded, priority funding for non-lethal technologies went to those things that they viewed to be used both domestically for riot control or for, control of crowds or against an adversary in a way that wouldn't create what the military views is the collateral damage, damage to property and assets you have to rebuild later. And that's part of the emphasis. One of the things they don't say is that many of these technologies can be, in fact, are lethal. In fact, the definition of the International Red Cross at one point was complaining about the definition which the military had adopted, which was 25% or less lethality. Made it non-lethal.
Oh, 25%. So if less than one out of four people die from exposure, then it's considered non-lethal.
Right. And so, and that would include, if you really wanted to look at that, look at a Claiborne landmine. It doesn't kill that large of a percentage. It just maims you. But, that's a ridiculous thought that it would be considered non-lethal. And I think they've changed a little bit, some of that now, but lethal and non-lethal is kind of a misnomer because things like gas, for instance, the kind of gas used in Moscow took care of Chechens that were, had taken over a movie theater, was used to knock everyone out, and it killed, a large number of the hostages and as well as, you know, number of these.
Because they just breathed in a little bit more than anybody else.
Right, and at the same time, that same gas was actually forbidden to be used internationally, but those treaties that deal with biological and chemical weapons, including the ones that we recently signed, exempt domestic use. So it's something even within the statutes within the United States, the international treaty is superior to what we have on the books to protect our own citizens, as was the case in Russia when they utilized that so-called non-lethal agent.
Well, that's one that's gotten a lot of press, then, is the mobile microwave skin irritant. And by the way, 130 degrees is enough to scald the skin,
right,
but not peel the hide off the bone. But you're saying varying the frequency, you can get various depths of penetration into the body, and different organs of the body are hypersensitive to certain resonant frequencies, and
yep,
you could actually cause permanent damage and even death.
Or heart attacks by interfering with heart rhythm, as an example, or interfere with breathing. You can create all kinds of disequilibriums within the body in terms of balance and so on by affecting the inner ear. I mean, you can do a lot by just altering that radio frequency energy with software, easily designed software to accomplish that with a known understanding of the technology that is possessed by military since at least the mid-80s. When those original handbooks were produced. So, you know, and that's ancient technology compared to what's been evolving, you know, along this line. But, you know, as people learn to better model the human system and then interact with it energetically, a lot of things become possible, and some of it quite, quite unnerving in terms of what can be done. But at the same time, an understanding of our biology and physiology that could really help in the health practices and practitioners around the world are being, you know, developed for destruction rather than for healing purposes by military planners, unfortunately.
Exactly right. And I think that's sort of the general theme that I want to make sure the listener keeps up with, is that many of these technologies, if applied in a different way and with, of course, much less power, could be used for beneficial things.
Absolutely.
Lots of health improvement things can be done with electromagnetic radiation. One of the things that I noticed in one of your DVDs was a set of, well, I'm going to call it electromagnetic acupuncture.
Right, right.
And these were quite beneficial.
Absolutely. In fact, acupuncture is recognized now by the, you know, World Health Organization and most universities that practice and teach medical practitioners. The fact of the matter is, acupuncture has been around a long time, and I'll tell a funny story. This is a great story about acupuncture. A good friend of mine was an electrophysiologist. He studied in Madrid, University of Madrid, graduating in the late 50s, and he was doing research work at the University of Queensland, Australia, in human movement studies, and was charting all of the electrical properties on the surface of the skin of the human body. And he had done this for a couple of years with graduate students coming in and him sort of measuring skin resistance differentials on the surface of the body. And he charted all this, and one day a guy came in and said, "Dr. Michaela, why do you have an acupuncture chart on your wall?" And he says, "Wait a minute, that was my work in the last 2 years." And the student brought in subsequently one of those old diagrams showing all those points. And Rejo, being good-natured as he was, you know, decided he better study acupuncture because all he did is rediscover something that was based not on anything mysterious but on actual electrical properties on the surface of the skin. And, you know, you can use needles to affect those points, which is kind of most Westerners kind of cringe at that thought.
Yeah, I don't care for needles myself.
No, and most of us don't. But there have been developed using a very, very low electric current. In this case, it's a 10 hertz square wave in the milliamp range, just producing a little bit sensation of electrical current. It's almost like a feather tapping on you is what it feels like. Nothing serious.
Feathers are better than needles.
Yeah, absolutely. And so consequently, you're going directly into those points, but this device actually locates them first by measuring that very same skin differential. So you run the point over the surface of the skin, and you actually locate the acupuncture points by measuring that difference, and then you can discharge energy by pressing a trigger into that point that's very, very low. It runs on a 9-volt battery, so it's not a lot of energy. But it
actually 9 volts. I particularly liked the little handheld unit that you had. It almost looked like a little Fluke multimeter.
Right.
With a little round probe on the end of it. If our listeners want to see a copy of this or a version of this, a model of this, they can go to earthpulse.com, and you've got these items.
Right, it's a pointer plus. Just do a word search under pointer, and you'll find it on that site. There's a little
there
search engine
in
there.
So it kind of acted like a little audio resistance meter, and when you found one of these points on the body,
right.
which, by the way, do not correspond with nerve bundles or
right.
muscles or anything else. It's
right.
like a, what did you call it, an energy?
It's a fourth system. You know, it's like there's not a circulatory system, muscle system, or nervous system. It's like a fourth one. It's the energy grid of a body. It's
the energy grid.
It actually flows. You know, the interesting thing about that is, you know, by a friend of mine, Rejo, actually, as he developed his knowledge, you know, from the 80s on, he actually developed electrolaser acupuncture technique where he used a class 4 cold laser and then around it put an electrode that was in resonance with the light being emitted from that particular laser. But he established a way to pulse that energy in such a manner that he could enter like a general point on the body, and then all the weaker points or places where the energy would not flow clearly would magnify a point. And a good example was I had had pneumonia a couple years before, one lung being damaged worse than the other. And as he did this, through the top of my head on my chest appeared in my main lung points these two red dots about the size of a dime. Now, no physical contact at all, except on the top of the head. And what he was doing was he was suggesting that the energy as it hit places where there was damage, the energy would not flow clearly. So you would get these little spots appear in those other related acupuncture points to those disorders. And he was able to demonstrate that, not just on me, but in treatment of over 14,000 people over about a 15-year period. Pretty remarkable technology, but using energy rather than needling to affect things much, much more.
So this is sort of like laser analysis of the health of the body using this energy grid.
Yeah, absolutely, and very effectively demonstrated and done. In fact, in Finland, where he eventually went back to practice, he trained 15 clinicians in this technique. He was challenged by their medical authorities all the way up to their Supreme Court, and was successful in sustaining his case, and he was able to go on and develop those practices prior to his death. And the
somebody, well, that's amazing to me. I mean, it's not amazing to me, but it's so typical to me that someone would instigate litigation, which ended up probably at no small expense, getting this individual all the way to the Supreme Court so that he could continue to practice his innovation.
Well, he was treating, successfully treating diabetes, some forms of cancer. I say some forms because there's hundreds of forms of cancer.
Sure.
He was successful in treating some folks with MS and other disorders that were considered either uncurable or required surgery. And you know, he did it with applying techniques of Chinese medicine that were ancient, but laying on top of that technology that allowed for much more accuracy. Because here's the thing. With needling, if you're a millimeter off, because the needle is so small, you miss the point, nothing happens. It's that critical. With a laser or an electromagnetic field, you've got, you know, especially in combination, you've got several millimeters of space, and at the same time, with an electromagnetic field, you might have a centimeter of active area that you can then be a little bit off and still have the effect that you're looking for. So that's where electro acupuncture and laser acupuncture become interesting. Plus, punching more energy in a way that seems to be much more effective, at least from the results that Rejo was getting, and his daughter carries on his work in Finland, actually.
Well, I guess the natural question that I have, being immersed in spectroscopy most of my life, is when the acupuncture chart was compared to the resistance chart that his grad students had been collecting, there was quite a correlation, was there not?
It was an absolute correlation. It was, which was really amazing because, you know, here you were. So you got to stop and think about this because it kind of, what did they have so long ago that would lead them to know that these points were the same points without instruments like ours?
That's the question.
Yeah, and you go, what is that? What does that mean? Well, if you think about artificial energy, man-made coherent forms of energy that we have surrounding us right now. If you take radio frequency energy as an example, they say there's 200 million times more of it around us now than was naturally in the background before radio 100 plus years ago. Which, when you think about that, that's pretty dramatic. So maybe the idea goes, and this is kind of my theory on the thing. If anybody saw the, in fact, I got to digress a minute. If anyone saw the Iceman on the Discovery Channel, they had this great segment on this guy they found in northern Italy or southern Germany, depending on whose argument you want to hear.
Yeah.
But it was a 5,000-year-old guy. They were doing the autopsy on him, and somebody noticed that he had tattoos over the surface of the skin that correlated with acupuncture points and meridians. And so when they completed the autopsy, they also noted that the disorders he had also correlated with those same tattoos. So there was some knowledge of these energy grids in Europe at the same time of perhaps even predating knowledge of this in China. And I think this was knowledge was maybe knowledge generally held by the healers, the shaman, or whoever those people were that were super sensitive enough to be able to detect those very slight differences in the surface of the skin. And I think that may be a reasonable explanation for how that knowledge evolved back when the background noise was a little quieter.
Yes, I was going to say, I don't think that we could develop that sensitivity today because I don't think you could find a place on the planet where there are not radio waves bathing you.
I don't think there is, and maybe there are people that have that sensitivity, but I don't know that. But I do know that by being able to measure that objectively, really adds, I think, a lot to the whole issue of acupuncture, something that's not really well understood by many in the West. But it kind of gives it that quantification that that those of us in the West require absolutely, especially in medical fields.
Well, besides the non-needling and what seems to be non-invasive, non-uncomfortable electric pulse that's put onto your skin, you mentioned a square wave, and that is at a specific frequency to convey or to commute some kind of comfort level or curing level to the person. What happens if that if the wrong frequency is used intentionally or unintentionally?
Well, then you can have problems. I mean, the idea that every element, every cell, every body organ, every whole body has resonant frequencies that are going to affect it in some way. It depends on how much energy is behind it and what frequency it's at. And more relevantly, a lot of change can take place without a whole lot of energy at all, just by the frequency rate in which energy is received. I mean, think about the chemical reactions that take place when you're visualizing flickering light. There was an incident in Japan a number of years ago where 700 kids went to the hospital with epileptic seizures from watching a cartoon that happened to maintain a flicker rate for a segment long enough to create epileptic seizures in those kids. And yet they're sitting, way away from the television screen. When they were looking at the radio frequency dosimetry handbook, it wasn't just for grossly overloading the organs with a whole lot of energy. It was also about what could you do to subtly interfere with the rhythm of what's going on, say, in the heart. So you would trigger the event without having to necessarily overload it in a way where when you did the autopsy, you would see burning or scarring or anything like this, except for the normal symptoms of a heart attack. And that's the kind of energy exchanges that much of this technology is based on. Whether it's applied for good or not, it makes a huge, huge difference. When you talk about light and sound effects on the mind, for instance, and in that DVD that you viewed, there was a light and sound device that we demonstrated that showed sort of the beneficial flicker rates, although folks with epilepsy can't use those devices because the light will interfere with their brain chemistry in a way that's pretty damaging. But for normal folks, what happens is your brain will lock on to very subtle energy if it's within the right frequency ranges. Even radio frequency energy at as low as 1/50th of what the Earth produces, if it's within the right window frequencies, can be quite dramatic in terms of entraining brain activity. And Delgado actually showed that in the mid-80s at Yale University.
Yes, he was able to alter aggressive behavior by applying different frequencies to test patients.
Right, and we're not talking, think about the background noise again, 200 million times more radio frequency energy, and yet through all that background noise, the right frequency reaches in, just like people dialing through the radio stations picked up our voices today when resonance occurred between the transmitter and the receiver. The same is true within the human body. There's a lot of action that takes place if you understand how energy affects the body. When you think about stress and just sort of the gross overload of coherent energy that we as humans receive within our urban settings, think about what you feel or sense when the power goes out. I mean, immediately, everyone notices how quiet it is.
Sure, it's like taking a deep breath. You just sigh and, wow, I've never realized it was so quiet.
Right, but the thing, if you stop and think about it, is almost like your whole body relaxes. It's
sure.
Almost like a body exhale because you're no longer compensating at a very subtle level for these external fields that impact you every day. It's the same feeling you get when you leave the urban areas and go out to the country and are quite a ways out. You don't feel that stress. Your whole body kind of relaxes. And it's like the background noise in a crowded room. You filter it out. You forget about it, and yet it's still there. When it goes away, you notice it immediately, how quiet things are. And
on the other hand, there are exposures that we submit ourselves to at very high pressure levels on purpose. One of the lectures that I give to young people is to be cautious of the kind of music that they listen to all the time.
Yeah, absolutely.
That the rhythm and especially the resonances and harmonies in music can have a biochemical effect on the body and the mind.
Yeah, you know, there was a guy, he was a physicist and a musician at Princeton, and he developed, he went a little bit further, and he analyzed what was happening chemically to the proteins within the body. And he was able to alter proteins using sound and following very specific mathematics and engineering that sound to affect things like plant growth, for instance. He could stimulate tomatoes to be about 30% more productive by altering their production of sugars and so on, making them also more pest resistant, but not really dealing with anything but sound. He found the same thing, that same tune, however, when played for a human, caused him to be ill, caused him to be sick.
Mm.
So, you know, when you start looking at some of this, what's beneficial for one thing may be not so beneficial to another. But think about some of those applications when you start to think about agricultural applications where sound experimentally now is being applied with pretty good success over about now 2 decades of use. A guy using sound for stimulating plant growth has been highly successful in showing the difference in plant growth using something as simple as that.
Yeah, he needs to get on Martha Stewart. We need to figure out how to use music instead of chemicals to grow bigger yams.
Well, and then the other thing they did is one of the things they noted was the sound waves actually cause the pores on the leaves of the plants to dilate, and his equation was it's like the songbirds in the morning.
Hmm.
And so when the leaves would dilate and the pores would dilate in the morning when dew is clustered on the leaves and colloidal minerals that are in particulate form fall on those leaves in the evening, that then sucks those very fine nutrients into the plant, or poisons for that matter. And so what they did is the folks clearing right-of-ways using really strong herbicides cut their herbicide volume in half, applied the sound to open the pores so they would suck the herbicides in, and it wasn't a total solution, but it cut the use of herbicides in half, which is, you know, certainly environmentally a beneficial thing to be.
So there's even more of a symbiotic relationship between the songbirds and the plants than we thought before.
Yeah, and then when you look at this guy who did this with sound, did it kind of accidentally, making observations and then intuitively applying them and seeing what would happen with some pretty good results. The physicist, on the other hand, at Princeton, and there's an article on this, I forget the name of it, it's on our website somewhere, in there. And it was a discussion that he had actually applied for, I guess, an international patent. I don't know whether it was ever granted, but he was able to show the exact same thing, but following a pattern of mathematics and taking it down a level to actually altering proteins, not just affecting how the plant uptakes its nutrients.
Well, one of the things that we want to try to get into, I guess, for the remainder of this hour and maybe the remainder of the show, we have talked about some studies and some effects, some beneficial effects that very, very low levels of properly selected frequencies to various points of the body can have very beneficial health benefits. They can lower blood pressure. They can, in some cases, treat things like diabetes, maybe by stimulating the pancreas to release insulin where it was unable to before. Maybe we can talk a little bit about biofeedback for the next 15 minutes or so, and then in the next hour we're going to get into more of the international and national applications in weapon systems using electromagnetic and sonic energy. And I want you listeners to please stay tuned, because this broadcast is going to be one for the archives. It will be listened to by about 14 million people a week. So we want to make sure that we get this information clear. So let's talk about biofeedback a little bit. We heard a lot about it in, I don't know, maybe the late 60s, early 70s, about, you know, being able to lower tension levels or find alpha sleep during meditation. But it's gone far beyond that, has it not?
Oh, absolutely. You know, brain biofeedback or neurobiofeedback has evolved dramatically since the 80s. The idea of being able to affect things that we didn't think were possible without chemical alterations. For instance, in neurobiofeedback or brain biofeedback, where you have maybe kids operating in a hyperactive way, which means their beta frequencies. Let me kind of give some background so we can put it in context. If you think about the brain, think about it in like four areas of primary activity. Think of delta, which is 1 to 4 hertz, or pulses per second, or vibrations per second. Think about it in that way. 1 to 4 hertz or vibrations per second is where you are in your deepest states of sleep, or where the 20-year Zen meditator might go and still be awake. You know, just kind of a strange state.
Hopefully not driving.
Right, not driving. The next state, theta, which is around, say, approximately 4 up to about 7 hertz, this is the stage that you are when you're sort of between awake and asleep, where you're still consciously aware of your dreams, but you're awake as well. People all have experienced that. And this is also where children between the ages of 3 and, say, 6 spend a good deal of their time, which may explain why their difficulty in distinguishing imagination from reality starts to make maybe a little more sense. The other thing is readiness to learn, because brain activity in that area seems to be more predominant. It's not a good time for necessarily academic learning, but a great time for learning languages, social skills, the kinds of things that kids seem to absorb like sponges in that age range. The next level up, alpha ranges, say 7 to 11 or 12 hertz, this is where you are in your creative states or in the zone, as the athlete might say. Above that, the low beta is where we are when we're actively engaged in conversation activity. The higher up in the beta ranges, up to maybe 30, 40 hertz, is where you start to get agitated and irritated. So what has been discovered is that within these ranges, you know, hyperactive kids tend to be running too high. You know, kids that are attention deficit disorders often are running too low. They're running in that theta range. And often they're just being diagnosed too early.
Yeah.
A little time. You know, and the behaviors will change.
I know teenagers like this.
Yeah. Well, you know, and things do. You know, chemistry really does affect brain activity in dramatic ways. And when you start adding chemicals in to change things, then there may be other effects that you don't really care for. Well, what brain biofeedback allows is for children that may be either hyperactive or attention deficit disordered, or people recovering from strokes, or even substance abusers have found very good luck using brain biofeedback, where they hook up to a 16-channel EEG that fits on the head, and they have now for kids these cool little helmets, so you don't need all the glues and goop that kids find objectionable, and they look kind of like little bicycle helmets. And you wear that, and in real time you look at a a computer screen, and you see your brain activity graphically illustrated. For little kids, it might be a bouncing ball, or it might be a guy running in a race, and the idea is to win the race or get the ball to bounce a certain level. And what the machine is doing is literally monitoring their brain activity, and when it hits those ideal ranges, giving them the feedback by the screen. And what they found is in 30 to 40 one-hour sessions, kids could do it without any hardware, without any equipment, and get into that ideal state of learning at will and not need the Ritalin or the chemicals that were previously being administered to them. In fact, in one Minneapolis school district program, they were able to take 80% of the kids after a year off of Ritalin, and they were just fine. They were integrating them back into regular education classrooms.
And unlike Ritalin, there's no long-term memory loss or emotional instabilities that occur at adolescence.
None. In fact, just the opposite. All of a sudden, these kids now can get into that zone that you and I may struggle for during different times of the day at will. And that's pretty dramatic. In other words, they can get into that ideal state and apply that at will by having gotten a little bit of feedback. And so brain biofeedback is used to kind of train you to do it yourself. There's other technologies that have been involved where the idea of brain entrainment, whether they're using electromagnetic pulses or whether you're using pulsing light or bioral beat created by sound waves, and I can explain that maybe in the next hour because it'll apply to some other things as well. But
exactly.
The point is you can do a lot to entrain brain activity to drive to those, say, meditative states or that place where accelerated learning is more possible or to those places if you have trouble sleeping. Those kinds of things have all been applied using sound, principles of sound and how it affects the brain and how the brain locks on to these external signals and begins to mirror them, which is the essence of where, sort of when you start to think about it, now, what are you doing with that brain activity? If you're acting on your own to enhance some aspect of performance is one thing, but because it takes so little energy, the development of weapon systems and applications for manipulating people is very tempting and unregulated at the present time, quite frankly.
Yes, well, maybe that's one of the things we're going to try to affect tonight. I do know many adults, too, that I guess in their late 40s, they seem to feel as though they are acted upon rather than acting upon the universe. And in order to keep themselves in that zone of, gee, I'm happy all the time, or I'm very pleased with my life as it is right now, one of, if not the biggest market for drugs are the mood elevators,
right?
Like what is it, Paxil and I forget the other names, Zoloft and some
right.
other mood elevators.
A whole variety of drugs now being widely prescribed.
Oh yes, so, I would say more than tens of millions of people are taking these every day, and they're not cheap.
No.
And I suspect that there are long-term effects of taking this stuff every day.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, you know, it has to pass through, it has to pass through the liver, number one. It has to pass through the body. Eventually, there's cumulative effects to any substance like this that you're taking on a regular basis over time. The trade-off is what people need to look at. And the other thing is, you know, humans are meant to experience a full range of emotions, and there are times when, you know, we're needing other kinds of help, and there are other alternatives out there. And those that are the least invasive, in my view, always should be attempted first and, you know, kind of gradually work your way into it. The thing about Americans and Westerners generally, you know, we want the instant cure, so the pill tends to address that. You know, with acupuncture as an example, oftentimes it's not, you know, an immediate symptom reliever. It may take a little bit of time, but over a very short amount of time, you start to see very dramatic results. But again, it's not the pill that you just take and immediately a symptom goes away and the underlying problems remain. And that's where a lot of Western medicine has gone. You know, we treat a lot of symptoms, but we don't solve the underlying problem. And I think that's the essence of what excites me about biofeedback, is you cure the underlying problem, and that gets exciting, and then you put it in the control of the individual, which even is more exciting.
Well, when we're talking about self-manipulation of our own physiological systems for benefit. I mean, like you said, every human is built to experience anger and frustration and even depression. It is a natural course of experience that we go through, conflict. How we resolve those things and how we utilize our ability to resolve those things, not only for ourselves but for others, is what is changing the race of man.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so too. And I think, you know, when you look at the, you know, when you start numbing people down and masking a lot of things, I don't think we really address the problem. And, you know, the things that we're facing as humans today in a technological world, which is really the crux of the work that, you know, we've been doing the last decade, is to say, hey, you know, it is complicated, it is changing. But within that, we need to retain our humanity and who we are, and how we reflect that in the development of our technology needs to free us. And it's not doing that right now. In fact, it's having the opposite effect. We're not the leisure society that everyone thought we would be in the 60s. You know, in fact, we were more so then than we are now. And, you know, the technology is the things that are on the horizons, if used rightly, can have dramatic impact on every human being on this planet. And that's, again, where, you know, we see the need of not just addressing sort of the sinister side of where technology goes, but also saying, hey, wait a minute, there's some great opportunities here to solve some of our really big problems if we apply technology in humans' interest and use it with a little bit different perspective.
In other words, we want to get it to the point where when we collectively say, or ask, wouldn't it be neat if we could do this, that we are not at first jumping at and funding a system that would manipulate or kill people in a military way, but that we would be able to spread benefit and peace and the ability to heal and to transcend some of the anxiety that plagues the planet of our population. In studying ancient civilizations, have come to this realization that the race of man has come to this point several times and destroyed itself.
Yeah.
And that we have a unique ability to communicate globally in almost a universal language. And this is half the battle. Communicating and overseeing by those scientists like Dr. Begich and myself and others that can see the benefits of health, energy, freedom, healing in these things, those are the kinds of ways that would benefit the race of mankind much better than seeking out ways to destroy one another. Well, we're coming up on a hard break. We'll listen to a little bit more bumper music, and then we will start into hour number two of X Squared Radio with Dr. Nick Begich as my guest, and I am Brooks Agnew. So we'll take that break right now. Welcome back to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. In here, the result is always positive. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. I want to make a short plug for our book, The Ark of Millions of Years is the Greatest Story on the Universe. Volume 1 solves the mystery of evolution and creation once and for all. In its 530 pages, you will learn about the origin and destiny of the Earth. You will find out why the 15th century Freemasons became so wealthy and powerful and how they had a profound effect on the outcome of the Revolutionary War. Without their help, we most certainly would never have become a nation based on freedom and liberty. You will learn about the ancient giants and their fathers, the Nephilim. You will learn about man's long history of interaction with off-worlders. You will learn the common origin of many of mankind's most powerful religious symbols. When you're done with that book, you will never look at the stars, your scriptures, or yourself the same again. It's available, of course, at arcofmillionsofyears.com or your local Barnes & Noble or Joseph Beth Booksellers and now Davis Kidd Booksellers. And remember, if you put in the code word STAR, S-T-A-R, while listening to this radio broadcast, you will receive free shipping. And if you buy the hardback, you will also receive the entire book on audio CD free of charge. We'll send that to you at a later date. I also want you to visit Dr. Begich's website at earthpulse.com. And I want you to pick up his two books. One is Earth Rising, The Revolution, and Earth Rising 2, The Betrayal of Science, Society, and the Soul. And I also want you to maybe listen to one of the test tracks on several of the audio CDs that he has on his website. If you like listening to space music or music while you drive or even try to sleep or meditate, this is a great, great resource for some artists that you might not necessarily be exposed to in the mainstream. And remember, if it's not mainstream, it's on BBS Radio. I was mentioning earlier I have the best producer in the business, so be sure to visit bbsradio.com as often as you can. So I'd like to welcome back Dr. Nick Begich for our second hour. How is the weather in Alaska?
Actually, we just went through about 3 days of the high 40s here in South Central Alaska, which is pretty unseasonal for us. We had about we have about 100 degree spread in temperature here at any given time.
Oh my God.
During the winter, between 50 below and 50 above, scattered around the state, and climate change is having a huge impact actually on my region of the state.
Yes, I noticed the northern areas of the world are all experiencing some pretty rapid changes. In 2007, the summer of 2007, am joining a scientific expedition to the North Pole. And we are not leaving out on the Canadian side, we're leaving out on the Russian side. And we are actually going as close as we can get to the actual North Pole, which right now is in the sea instead of on ice. But we will be going on a Russian icebreaker because the Canadian icebreaker is diesel-powered and we just can't go that fast or that far through the ice, and we're going out for 21 days. So this is going to be quite the expedition, 39 other scientists and myself, and we will bring back evidence that that will surely make for a few more books, to be sure.
Absolutely. You know, that the whole issue of climate change, I've been here all of my life, and I'm now 47, and, you know, I've watched glaciers recede historically, and when you start looking at even older records of the era, you know, during the Gold Rush era about 100 years ago, you find that glaciers have been receding pretty consistently since. You can even go back just a few thousand years. You know, the last mastodons were only 4,000 years ago up here. You know, that's not very long ago when you start to think about how fast things change.
Well, that's true, and the core drilling of glaciers has been a great atmospheric historical record of what's gone on in our planet. And there's no small amount of controversy as to how long it takes for those layers to build up in the ice. Certainly, mean temperatures of the Earth greatly affect whether ice is being forming or being formed or whether it's being sublimated.
That's exactly right. And you know, the thing about a lot of the dating, it's a little, you know, it's obviously a lot of it is still theoretical. Some of it's a little more accurate. You know, it just depends on what you're using. You know, tree ring dating, of course, doesn't go back that far, but probably some of the more accurate rating systems they've got out there these days. But you know, when you start to look at the historical changes. And again, this is where the technology and mankind sort of overlap. You know, there's a certain amount that's probably natural. In fact, my personal belief is the majority of what we're seeing is based on natural cycles. But the idea that technology's been evolved that can now interact within those cycles dramatically, I think that's, again, an area that we've spent a little bit of time and have talked about some of the things evolving in that area as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk a little bit about that technology. In the last hour, we talked in the last 15 or 20 minutes about biofeedback and being able to use our mind's own abilities to control its own biochemistry, not just the brain, but also body components, and using a feedback device so that you can alert yourself when you're getting close to that optimum range of health and,
right,
and balance. And with those instruments, thereby enhance your ability to weather stress and be able to learn and imagine without some of the psychosis that that maybe is needless because we don't have that skill without those instruments.
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, it's it's the other side of that double-edged sword, you know, the applying of technology to enhance human performance as opposed to degrading it. The same basic principles or understandings of how the body and brain operate lie at the core of either direction in which the science might go. And I think that's a big part of a lot of this, is when you start to develop. And if you look at science, I mean, think about the Air Force budget. Back in the late 90s, 40% of the equipment bought in the Air Force budget was for those black projects, those projects so secret even Congress didn't know what they were appropriating the money for. Now, you're talking billions and billions of dollars. And the things being evolved there and developed there, many of them can be quite useful in terms of understandings and applying those understandings to the health sciences. And there's sort of a division in the sciences, you know, between the physicists and the mathematicians kind of go one direction, and the chemists and the folks interested in biosciences kind of go another direction, and they each develop their models based on their understandings. And, you know, underlying those chemical models are the physics of it all. And I
sure
think this is where the separation does us a lot more harm than good, because when you start to bring those things back together, those areas of science back together, and you start to look at what can you do to affect things chemically using energy, the physics of it, if you will, then things start to become much more easily understood by both sides of the discussion, you know, both the pure physicist not thinking about health effects and then the health scientist not thinking about underlying energetic effects on chemistry.
Yes, and of course, when we're talking about black projects, we're talking about a career development area of government separate from the elected part of our government, Congress, which is an endless cycle of two-year laymen that kind of get into politics and get out, and some of them do manage to hold on to a dynasty. How they do it, being elected every 2 years, is beyond me with all the talent that's out there. And then the Senate, being elected every 6 years, it's, of course, a lot easier to build a dynasty committee by committee that way. But even they are really not aware of some of these research projects long before they develop into full-blown weapon systems. Some of them develop into weapon systems that are used in a limited basis, especially at time of war.
Yeah.
And notwithstanding that, they are also out of our sight.
Right. And, the bureaucracies, you know, having come out of, again, coming out of government, you know, I can tell you the bureaucracies kind of come in with this attitude in terms of a lot of the entrenched organizations is, we just have to wait another cycle of elections. We'll get rid of this guy.
Or
especially in the case of the executive branch. You know, they know that guy's only going to be there 8 years at the most.
We saw that on national television the last couple of decades. We've seen government officials in there before congressional hearings. One side of the aisle would praise them for showing up and, gee, you look wonderful today and aren't you smart? And the other side would ask questions, and I think they're only allowed maybe something like 10 minutes or 5 minutes to ask the question and get an answer. But if you sort of filibuster through that, you never have to give an answer.
Right, and this is the problem with the whole process is, you know, you're capped at how information is developed, and then you're capped at how you interpret that information. You rely on the very institutions that need the oversight to give you the expertise to interpret what the heck they're telling you.
Well,
and,
I know,
and there aren't many scientists in political office, quite frankly.
Yes, exactly. And of course, there's a lot of research being done on the civilian side, but it has shifted. Back in the days when, let's say, Nikola Tesla was making his breakthroughs in AC technology,
right,
he showed off things at expos. I just recently read an article actually written by Edgar Rice Burroughs where he attended a 1933 expo where Nikola Tesla was demonstrating electromagnetic effects, and he actually got Mark Twain to stand up on the stage, and Nikola exposed Mark Twain to an electromagnetic frequency that was supposed to tingle him, and what it ended up making him do is it actually liquefied his bowels,
right,
and he soiled himself on stage. He had to run to the
right
restroom. So unbeknownst to Nikola, he had, in open public view, demonstrated one of the most effective weapon systems that we have in warfare today. And that
they have one now.
Yeah.
That'll
I know
nice
the
time.
Navy uses it because a friend of mine just got back from Kuwait, and he said that they had deployed it. Now, he didn't see it used, but he did see it drive off to Baghdad. So,
yeah, it's all part of that non-lethal weaponry that's developed over time by just exploiting these bits of knowledge that have been gained about our health and physiology and what drives our system ultimately. When you think about, and again, thinking about all of that, by just altering the energy to actually kill someone is not that big of a step. And the thing that many of us need to recognize is the idea that some of these systems that are meant to interfere with brain performance, stop and contemplate that for a moment. And I mean, we have in this country basic principles that we sort of agreed are there, religion, assembly, freedom of speech, freedom of the press. All of those require first freedom within the cavity occupied by the brain. I mean, that's something that should not be, in my opinion at least, altered without our consent in any way. And that's something that is not currently the case. In fact, the technologies that have evolved, there was a paper published called The Mind Has No Firewalls at the U.S. Army War College, their publication Perimeters, back in, I believe it was 98, in the fall of 98, but I may be wrong on that. But it's quoted within our book, and it was an earlier publication from the Russian military journal Orienteer, where they suggested that you could alter the brain activity remotely of people over huge areas just by piggybacking a signal on energy already going in to the region. Let me find the quote and I'll read it for you. It's a really revealing one-liner, and it says, "A psychotronic generator which produces a powerful electromagnetic emanation capable of being sent through telephone lines, TV, radio networks, supply pipes, and incandescent lamps. This would manipulate the behavior of those in contact with the signal," unquote.
What do you mean by manipulate?
The kinds of things that that they've been able to accomplish easily is the idea of changing people's basic emotional state. In fact, it was demonstrated by a guy named Smirnov at the Russian Academy of Sciences on a program called Undercurrents, which is a Canadian broadcasting program aired in February of 99. And it was actually demonstrated being able to, in terms of visual things like TVs and computers, being able to give visual imaging in every 25th frame that you wouldn't really detect with the eyes but would have a dramatic effect. The other thing that was demonstrated is just modulating a signal that affected general emotional state, made people passive or aggressive, or even providing suggestions in one instance where they put suggestions and masked it in background noise and white music up to the street level, and had people within 24 hours responding to that message by acting on it. And these are things that are done and can be done remotely. I mean, you're not talking about having to be right in the guy's neighborhood. You can affect an energetic system, in other words, affect a TV broadcast. They say that in the first Gulf War that we used this in the radio broadcasts that were broadcasting the Muslim music and prayers into the region also had a signal that created anxiety and fear. And the consequence of that was we saw the fourth largest army in the world collapse like schoolgirls on the first fire drill. You know, I mean, it was ridiculous what we saw happen there.
Yes, they crawled out of bunkers with their hands on top of their heads, and many of them complained that they had not slept in 30 days.
Yeah.
And that when they did close their eyes, they had horrible visions that plagued them.
Right. And so when you start to look at what the press said afterwards, and the Scottish press reports came out afterwards, we speculated in it, you know, during the time that it was probably using some of the technologies we knew were available to the military at the time. But it was Scottish press came out in a couple years after the war was over and said that was the most significant weapon used in the conflict, because it resulted in, you know, the immediate ability to overrun the country. And, you know, we blamed it on the ordnance, you know, bombing the heck out of them. But, you know, Dresden and London were bombed like crazy, civilian populations during World War II, and we didn't see that kind of...
No, all it did was make their resolve that much firmer.
Right, and we're dealing with a population that certainly were committed to the battle. And what we saw was this giving up in mass of a trained army just didn't fit the character of the events at all.
Well, I want to, lest we should not give this enough attention, because it's going to play a big part in what we talk about for the next hour and a half, I want to impress upon people that when you talk about remotely, you're not talking about laying this over their favorite music program. They don't even have to have a radio for this to have an effect on them.
Right. In fact, there's a paper that was done for the Air Force. It's New World Vistas, Air and Space for the 21st Century. And this is a quote from what they project would be possible. And it says, and I quote, "It would also appear possible to create high-fidelity speech in the human body, raising the possibility of covert suggestion and psychological direction. Thus, it may be possible to talk to selected adversaries in a fashion that would be most disturbing to them," unquote.
Well, this is voice of God stuff.
Yeah, exactly right. In fact, on that theme, you know, since publication of the book Earth Rising, where we quote that, there was a guy, Woody Norris, that actually won the MIT Lemelson Prize for creating hypersonic sound, where he could literally take someone in a crowd and beam a signal directed at them that would be perceived in their head as whatever he wanted to play, music, voice, whatever. And they would hear it, and no one around them would hear a thing. And that won an MIT prize in April of this year, $500,000. It was in an AP story in April of...
Well, what about if you made that a macro broadcast? Let's suppose that in conjunction with using HARP, bouncing this off the ionosphere, lacing whatever ELF waves are needed to create this mass vision, shall we say,
yeah,
could you irradiate a large area, a state or a country, with this kind of vision to create sort of a mass revelation?
Well, and that's, yeah, actually, that's exactly where it all goes. In fact, the military refers to this under the general category of controlled effects. And in a 2004 publication, June 2004, in the Air Force Research Laboratory's Technology Horizons, Research for America's Future, there's actually a short paper on controlled effects by the head of the Directed Energy Directorate for the Air Force. And this is what he says is possible.
Go ahead.
Wait till after the break?
Well, this is not science fiction.
No, not at all. Not at all. And here's what he says. He says, by studying and modeling the human brain and nervous system, the ability to mentally influence or confuse personnel is also possible. Through sensory deception, it may be possible to create synthetic images or holograms to confuse an individual's sense, visual sense, or in a similar manner, confuse his senses of sound, taste, touch, or smell, unquote.
Image?
A total image where you have... I mean, where it's not even projected outward, it's projected inward, so you have the visual, the smell, the taste, the touch, this whole experience that is synthetic from its core. And that's and here's where controlled effects goes. It's really three stages within this article. First, to attack hardware, to affect electronic systems that may be running the hardware directly. The other is to affect software, that stuff that drives those circuits. And then the third, ultimately, is the human being, and this is what they're getting to here. The target for controlled effects or information warfare ultimately is the human being. And so these technologies that are evolving are designed to attack that, because it doesn't matter how good your computer software is, it doesn't matter how good your hardware is, if the human beings can't operate it properly.
Yes, if they're sitting at their terminals afraid of what they do not know, but they're just in fear, you can put special stress upon them that even the best training cannot overcome.
Right, and you know, when you look at brain activity, for instance, and people experiencing fear, you get very incoherent brain patterns. Unlike when you're experiencing love or compassion, you get very rhythmic or coherent brain patterns, the kind that lend themselves to good decisions and smart living. You know, those incoherent patterns that emerge from anger and fear and anxiety don't allow you to think clearly, and consequently the decisions you make are usually the wrong ones, and occasionally, statistically, you make a few right ones.
I know this to be true, because I have been in love with the same woman for 26 years, and I always make good decisions.
There you go. But you know, these are, you know, these again, when you think about the technology and where it goes, it's all driven by humans ultimately, and that's again where the base values that we hold individually and in common, I think, need a little more emphasis, you know, the humaneness of it all. I mean, when you think about people these days, people don't think about human beings. They talk about us as consumers and taxpayers and Republicans and Democrats and whatever else they want to label us.
Constituents, customers.
Yeah, customers, that's the other one. And, you know, we're so much more than that. All those things are our reflections of what we do as human beings. They aren't who we are at all. And I think the essence of technology in terms of freeing us has look what it's done, you know, in terms of how people spend their time, but at the same time, look what it's done.
Well, I'm sure that it's empowered, and we've talked about this on this program before, it has empowered suppliers to meet the needs of the consumer much better. They have targeted their advertising to those areas that like to buy orange juice. And they even know the demographics of who buys them because of the little discount UBCs
right.
that you swipe at the desk, which has all your personal information
right.
on it.
Right.
And you know, I'm sure the computers are fast enough now that they can, if someone commits a crime, they can say, okay, what videos has he rented? How much orange juice does he drink? When's the last time he rented a car? And if he has
right.
A GPS chip in his cell phone, where has he been the last 45 days?
And where is he right now? You know, the interesting thing about that is there's a book, Body of Secrets, that's the anatomy of the National Security Agency. And it's got an interesting thing. You know, a lot of the supercomputers and the technologies that evolved in terms of supercomputing have been because of NSA funding, because of their need for better and better and faster hardware. And the quantum computers that they're predicting will, you know, one day emerge in not too distant future, you know why they're so important. And when you think about this, what it takes to run a calculation that might take a trillion years to compute, a quantum computer will be able to do it, according to that text, in 1 hour. So when you start to think about data storage and sorting that data, virtually everything then becomes available, and there's no real boundary set. So when you want to profile someone based on, again, just statistical analysis of large amounts of information over big populations, you can get some pretty accurate readings, and then you can use that information, for instance, for political advertising. Figure out what a person's belief system is, spin your message just to address that, and forget the 90% of your message he or she would disagree with.
Sure. It's like doing away with the Electoral College. If that was done, then there'd be only about, 8 major cities in the country that would see campaigns. Those of us in the western part of North Carolina wouldn't see squat because we don't have enough voters.
Right. You know, and here's the thing that happens when you start to look at the mechanizing of a lot of this. Some things should remain on manual. You know, voters' tabulations is one of them, in my view. Computers should not be tabulating and storing that data until after paper ballots have been cast that are properly stored. And
take that one step further. They should not be releasing the results to the press until after the last polling place closes.
Absolutely. And you know, these are... You know, media, I'll tell you what happened. I was in Australia a year or so ago lecturing, and they had just instituted mandatory voting. It was required by, you know, some civil fine if you didn't vote.
What a great idea.
Well, yes and no, but think about this. Brooks, right now with the majority of people not voting, which is the case because they're totally uninformed and disconnected, if they were required to vote, what would be motivating them? Would it be the last big bucks spending spree on the media? Or
sure,
it would be
what's in it for me.
So here's what happens. I'm a little bit of a contrary, you know, on the surface, everyone does it. I did it too. I said, what a great idea. And then I thought about it. I went, wait a minute. That means that everyone riding the fence, which at that point is probably 70% of the population, what's going to move them off the fence is whatever they see in the last advertisement. And that means that only people with money, lots of money, will drive election outcomes. Whereas if you have a small segment of the population, it's a heck of a lot easier to convince, say, 16% of the people you're right when 30% are voting, then 51% equally footed. So
sure, the ones that are paying attention to the debates, those are the people you want voting.
Yeah, and here's the thing. If you're going to do that, if you're going to create mandatory voting, then you do the second thing, and you say nobody can commit more than $50 to a campaign, and there is no corporate money. Because now you take the money out of the equation, and you can't be rich and spend all your own money to just buy a race. You've got to cap it. Now people have to believe in you and vote. I would go along maybe with that.
Yeah, but maybe then you'd have a race of ideas.
Exactly, because the only way you're going to get them out is people got to believe in you enough to help get it out there, and that takes a lot of people.
Unfortunately, what I have noticed is that the party and the candidate that's the incumbent, the one that's in power, doesn't want to lose power.
Yeah.
And so you mentioned a couple of key words a few minutes ago, and that was information warfare.
Yeah.
How, well, I guess our listeners in particular are open-minded to information warfare, but how a political party or an individual in power could use that to keep opponents from ever coming to run against him in an effective way. But besides that, we are juxtaposed maybe half a dozen or a dozen nations in this world that have the technological firepower to conduct an effective information war. But give us a sense of maybe what would be used to conduct that war and how it would be prosecuted.
Okay, in terms of political outcomes, think about advertising in general in terms of television advertising as a good example. If you maintain in the background, or by the way you relate with those images, a flicker rate that puts you in a highly suggestive state while you're viewing that commercial each and every time you view it, that message is going to anchor much differently than, say, someone not understanding that technology and not applying it to their advertising development. Yet there's no restriction if you're not using, say, subliminal words or something like this, but you're just using the flicker rate because those that control federal communications, including the airwaves, aren't regulated in that way.
Huh.
So you've got a knowledge that's widespread. Well, you know, it's known. These things have been known for decades. People who are smart about the design of advertising apply it. You know, a good example is there was a simpler system was applied in Japan, and it was just taking verbals that were below the perception of hearing and putting them on in seven languages on the elevator music in department stores, you know, that kind of music they play in the background, and it reduced shoplifting by 40%. Now, the thing about that is if they had some songs in aisle 10 that weren't moving, you know, you might be able to motivate some sales. That's where the, you know, is that manipulation? Is that fair? Would they apply it that way? I'm sure people have. Because they can, and there's no regulation necessarily in a lot of these applications that say they can't. But the technology, and that's where the very beginning of the show, talking about technology doubling every 10 months from the invention of the wheel to where we are today, the regulations don't keep up with the technology to start to say, hey, is this operating in humanity's best interest? Is this technology being applied in a way that enhances, or is this violate some fundamental principle that we ought to examine? And that's not being asked nor examined at the present time.
And currently the system of doing that in this country is just people like you and I raising enough money, spending our own money, our own time, going out and telling people, hey, this is going on.
Yeah.
Maybe we should have hearings. Maybe we should try to pass a law or put some regulations in place. But there's certainly no mechanism for civilian oversight when these brilliant people in the bureaucratic part of our government say, wouldn't it be neat if we could do this?
Yeah, and you know, and the thing about it is, you could create institutions. You know, we had posed this in Europe at one point, and it was actually being championed by one of the guys who helped us get legislation on the HARP issue dealt with there. And it was on an international whistleblower mechanism. And unfortunately, you know, he's no longer in office to push it, but we still believe that that needs to be developed, not just on government, but on private industry as well. Because now what happens is often, you know, private industry does the dirty work that government never wants to disclose. And as private corporations, they can engage in a lot of experimental work without the same kind of oversight. And so, you know, there's the idea of being able to go to a third party and report on things of public concern, whether they're misuses of technology or waste of public money or something else that's, you know, an environmental disaster not being reported that needs to be, making people accountable is not a bad thing. In fact, it ought to be encouraged, and there ought to be institutions set up to make it happen in this country and in the rest of the world, for that matter.
Well, that's the way you and I feel, but when we are talking about billions, perhaps over time, trillions of black dollars funneling out to private corporations that are developing these things, then this protest, this oversight, this scrutiny impacts the income and thus the kickback ability of those black projects to maintain momentum,
yeah,
and to maintain technological advantage. So this electronic warfare, this information warfare, goes further than that, because as we are sold, and I'm going to use that word loosely here, on the crime of identity theft, let's say, we are being sold a method of identification that is irrefutable, uncopyable, so that you will be safe, you law-abiding citizen.
Right.
And so if you voluntarily, let's say, let's just cut to the chase and go to subcutaneous RF chips that contain all the information about you, your
yep.
birth, your DNA propensities, everything that they want to put on there. And now you are identified. Now nobody can be you except you. But what happens if the party in power now says, we don't want this kind of scrutiny on this new space-based weapon? So we want all the naysayers and the people that are bringing this out on radio programs and publishing blogs and magazines, we want them to go away.
Yeah, you know, that's exactly, you know, the idea of implant technology, you know, always has bothered me, always. And when you go back to 1989, there was a paper, Revolution in Military Affairs and Conflict Short of War, by the U.S. Army War College. And what they talked about was using implant technology. Now, this is quite a while ago. You know, things have changed a lot in terms of what you can store on these. Back then, they were interested in for GPS, geographic positioning systems, where they could find servicemen if they were in combat by having an implant under the skin.
Or government officials if they're kidnapped.
Right, and they use it for both those purposes, actually, and you know, since 89, and heads of state and many others. In fact, they're promoting the same technology now for people to use if they have Alzheimer's or degenerative diseases that are affecting their mental capacities, or they're using it, pushing it for children, fear of kidnapping. You know, all these fears they try to build up to create demand for this. At the same time, the identity theft fear, you know, it's the biggest crime in America that's not prosecuted, you know, which is like a ridiculous thing. I had it happen to me, and what I ended up talking to was a greenhouse collecting statistical information with no interest in pursuing any investigative work at all. And, you know, the thing about when you look at all of this, it's really become quite invasive. I mean, the use of all of your information for pressing political outcomes or helping you make economic decisions or whatever really has become highly manipulative. And I think that's, when you think about implant technology, the ultimate manipulation, you know, it means that your sense of privacy is totally, absolutely removed, because these implant technologies will allow not only GPS but full data collection on individuals in a way that has never been done. And people say, well, I'm anything to hide. What am I worried about?
Sure. What do you have to worry about, you law-abiding citizen? You're fine. We're protecting you.
You know, and here's the thing, is who's in power determines, you know, a whole lot of things. And The reason that we have such strong provisions for privacy in this country and it's so valued has because of abuse of power by those in power historically throughout humanity's existence on this planet. The idea of being directed and controlled, which is the objectives of governments that really don't lift people up anymore but hold people back. And that's the kind of application of this technology you're going to see immediately. You think right now already in the Attorney General's office of Mexico, a couple hundred people have been implanted with this technology to track their movements. You know, where does it start and where does it end? It ends when everyone and all of your transactions are controlled and regulated in some fashion. And I don't think that's the correct way for human beings to live.
Right. And maybe when you combine this with GPS and some demographic software, now you have information warfare combined with the ability to broadcast a radio beam that could go to that demographic and convince them to do or undo something.
Yeah, just those people. And, you know, here's the thing. It's human beings are meant to be independent and free. Anything that runs contrary to that, we need to ask ourselves, you know, a lot of questions. And it's always this dimension of, you know, what amount of personal security and safety will you trade off for your freedom and your sense of security? And here's what the U.S. Army War College said is about a lot of the technologies, implant technologies, for instance, and some others. For instance, EMP, knocking out aircraft so that you could knock out, say, an airplane full of terrorists and hope they were really terrorists and cause them to crash, for instance. But, you know, what it said is these things would violate American values. They would violate the very standards that the country was based on. And so instead of stopping there, like you would think our places training our Army would consider that values of the American public are, in fact, what they're in business to protect, would say, okay, that's where that can't go. But they didn't. Instead, they created within this paper, the RMA, this whole scenario on how to create an environment of fear based upon international terrorism and international drug trafficking. And this was written in 89. And what's happened since 1989, if you add up all of the, you know, and that's not to say these problems aren't big problems, but add up all the terrorism in the United States, domestic and foreign, over the last 15 years, and you might come up with 5,000 people dead, including all the people killed in the Gulf conflict on the U.S. side, for that matter.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's a lot of people. But if you compare it to how many people die of medical malpractice in the United States, according to Harvard, over that 15-year period, you get 1.5 million. And how many column inches have been dedicated to medical malpractice in the last few years?
Well, it certainly has made a change in malpractice insurance.
Right, but you know what? Half of those malpractice cases related are drug interactions. And you know what? The simplest solution for drug interactions is database an individual's drugs, whether they're prescribed by the dentist or the doctor or the surgeon, and then knowing what those drug interactions are, computers can tell physicians, hey, can't prescribe that one because it'll conflict with this one.
Try That's right.
One. And then you know what? Half of those problems go away by applying knowledge and under the regulations that protect medical information already, making sure that information is adequately protected.
Yes, I believe that, but we should be able to do it without implanting a chip under the
Absolutely.
Skin to do it.
Absolutely. And this is this kind of overreaching is where Americans and people from around the world stand up and go, wait a minute, you know, this is in conflict with the way we see the world, and as a consequence you get policy changes. But without people standing up saying, hey, wait a minute, you know, and people can do it. I know right here where I live, one of the big national banks, national chain banks, was leaving Alaska, and they were one that required your thumbprint for someone to cash a check, which I
mm-hmm.
highly resent. You know, I mean, I always was taught fingerprints are for criminals, you know.
Yes, I've never given my thumbprint.
No, and I wouldn't play. And I was with a friend of mine, and we went, you know, and they knew me, so they never asked me for it. But my friend was cashing a check, which, you know, I had written right there at the counter for him, and they all knew me, and they said, we need his ID, and he shows the ID, and he goes, well, we need his thumbprint. I said, wait a minute. I said, why do you need his thumbprint? I'm right here. I'm writing him the check. It's all good. You know me. And they go, yeah, but it's for your protection. I said, well, I don't need protection today. Just cash the man his check. And they wouldn't do it. And so they were leaving Alaska at that time, and I called the public relations person of the bank taking over, and I said, look, I want to know if you're going to have this policy of fingerprinting customers before I remove my money from your bank and write some letters to the editor and start talking to legislators I know about regulating you guys out of this ability to do this. And you know what? They didn't do it when they took over that bank. They dropped the policy entirely. And it just took one person making one phone call to the right person saying, hey, wait a minute. Have you ever caught them? How many people do they really catch? And you know how people resent this? For the one you catch, you do more in public damage for your reputation.
Yeah, I don't think they catch too many criminals with the thumbprint.
No, of course not. You know, I mean,
it's used for another database. It'll be used at a later date.
Exactly.
Who are the customers of Dr. Nick Begich? Well, we have these thumbprints.
Well, here's the other issue, is when you take a look at the Trusted Traveler program they're now pushing in the airports to try and get you to sign up and give up some biological information, whether it be a thumbprint, an iris scan, or what have you, so you can transit the airport a little quicker. So what does that make everybody else, the untrusted travelers? You know, I mean, it's this whole game of trying to create a herd mentality, the rush to an overreaching government. Now, if you were living in Germany in the 1930s and you were asking the question, well, what do I have to fear? I have nothing to hide. You might have had a different view of that in the 1940s. And this is where privacy in the United States always needs to be reflected, and not necessarily the government you have, but the government you might get.
Yes, and all of this being said, as we wind up this hour, I want to have everyone understand that the United States is only one of a dozen countries that are developing this technology. And it's not just the identification theft. It is the manipulation of demographics with the intention of subjugating that population, whether it's mainland China over Taiwan, or Russia over Chechnya, or North Korea over South Korea, or the United States over factions of the country that would stand up and protest various policies of the administration, be it the Bush administration or Clinton administration or whoever. This power now exists. And as I said in the very first part of our broadcast tonight, our nation, most nations in history, do not have a good reputation for laying down weapons once we have the ability to use them. We almost look for a place to use that weapon. And I only need to mention the words Hiroshima and Nagasaki to make my point.
Yeah, and you know, there's actually, we demonstrated an infrasound device in the European Parliament back in 1997, and after our demonstration, it actually transferred sound information through the skin in this case, where people heard that proverbial voice in the head. And as part of one of the most comprehensive security and disarmament resolutions they ever passed, beyond addressing the HAARP issues which were addressed there, and this was their resolution, A40005/99, it says under Section 27, calls for an international convention introducing a global ban on all developments and deployments of weapons which might enable any form of manipulation of human beings, unquote. To get them to that point of passing that as part of a security and disarmament resolution really took an awful lot of evidence. Beyond demonstrating the instrument, we also took with us over 3 feet of unclassified academic studies, government records, and reports on how these technologies had evolved over a 40-year period.
And I assume you don't mean 3 feet long. I think you mean three feet stacked high.
Yeah, exactly right. So. And it was, we had made 4 trips over in advance of that, and we formed a coalition of social Democrats, conservatives, and Greens, starting with the conservatives and Tom Spencer, who chaired the Foreign Affairs Committee at the time. We were able to get that section of the resolution passed, and hopefully the European Parliament, as we've seen it, has continued to act, and hopefully they'll continue to act in that direction because, you know, their population understands what it's like to be oppressed. Europeans have it in their recent memory, particularly Eastern Europeans.
Well, one of the things that I'd like to make clear is that we are discussing information warfare, not just gathering information and using it against each other, but also manipulating, you know, violating the very firewall of the brain with subliminal or even overt suggestions, either broadcast by sound or subliminals on radio waves or TV broadcasts, or directly into the brain using HAARP or other electromagnetic weapons as a form of warfare. There must be a form of defense, and the only defense that we can think of is information. It is informing the public of what can and is being done. This is not futuristic technology. This is technology that is in the hands of world leaders right now. It has been funded by billions and billions of dollars. It has been built. It has been tested. And what we want to do as civilian scientists is we want to keep the public aware of what's going on so that when this legislation comes up, you'll know what it is, you'll know what's at stake, and you will participate.
And no, it is about information, you know, and that's always been a big part of our work, you know, it's trying to translate. You know, in those two books, Earth Rising, The Revolution, Earth Rising 2, there's over 1,000 referenced sources. Then, you know, I mean, when you read something on a page, you can look at the bottom of the page and see exactly where that data comes from. And, you know, and what it does is it really equips people, whether they be scientists or lay people, to take this information, have a discussion with their local legislators and political leadership, and talk to them about what this technology is and educate them on it, and you have the references so that the engineering types can go pull them and look at it themselves and see what that data really says. And that's how change really can happen. It's not someone's opinion. It's just a platform of factual information that's based on those very studies that the government has based their funding on. And so we're just talking from the same sheet, just taking a look at what's underlying the principles under which this technology is being advanced. How do we determine how it can best be advanced? I mean, in the area of weather modification, the whole area of HAARP, as it came up in terms of a lot of its applications, the guy behind it, Dr. Ben Eastland, has advanced his ideas on weather modification first for the European Space Agency, and then he just delivered a paper October 11th at Penn State's Lehigh campus on what was about manipulation of weather using 1,600 times less energy than he thought was once needed when he originally designed the HAARP program. So scientists have taken ideas and continue to advance in areas that, you know, two decades ago were considered impossible, and today are now being treated very credibly at a time when energy itself and thinking about energy and preemptive warfare, the idea of having systems that act as fast as the speed of light, you know, at tremendous velocities or remotely, and preemptive warfare that says, hey, we don't tell anyone we're mad at them, we just pull the trigger. It may not be the United States pushing that button. You know, the Chinese spend $40 billion a year on military and defense, and, of course, we spend 10 times that, you know, not to mention what we spend direct warfare, but, you know, what do you get in China for $40 billion? You get a lot more than 10 times what you get in the United States.
Right, exactly right.
And you have a centralized government that takes its hundreds of millions and billions of people and pulls from them the absolute best minds and puts them into the sciences to make sure that they stay technologically agile, because what makes a country strong in the 21st century is their command of technology, and then secondly is their ability to articulate that technology into production. And the Chinese have the biggest production facility seen since the Industrial Revolution, and we've bought and paid for it, yet ideologically they run quite to the contrary of most free-thinking people, and yet here we are creating a technology manufacturing base that, not like World War II, would take months to switch over. Today it switch out the computer program and a whole other board comes out the other end of the machinery. It's an
exactly
instant,
right.
Instant change.
And when we talk about, you know, weather manipulation by these systems, I'm going to quote from page 249 on the book, and this is a U.S. Army potential weather modification capabilities, Air Force 2025.
Right.
They talk about storm enhancement being used to deny operations. In other words, you send a terrible thunder and hailstorm upon an infantry, and they can't get their jeeps out of the mud. Or you deny precipitation. You deny fresh water. You induce a drought. You wipe away clouds or fog so that they can be spotted by space surveillance systems. You increase their vulnerability. You also enhance friendly forces participation avoidance. In other words, you clear away bad weather or improve visibility so that friendly forces can have open skies, in other words, and only your enemies have fogs and clouds preventing their visualization. You can also maintain airfield operations, enhance PGM effectiveness, and you can also defend against the enemy's capabilities. So it's not as though the United States is the only one generating these effects. And this is remarkably poignant to talk about in a year when we have had a record-breaking 26 tropical storms, 14 of which turned into hurricanes, 3 of which turned into Category 5 hurricanes, and caused over $10 billion worth of economic damage.
That's right. In fact, you know, this is kind of interesting. You know, when you talk about weapons of mass destruction and you talk about weather modification, they certainly fit the category. If you go back before 9/11, back to April 28, 1997, there was a presentation being made in a conference on terrorism and weapons of mass destruction by Defense Secretary William Cohen and Senators Lugar and Nunn. And here's what Cohen said in the press briefing afterwards. He said, and I quote, "Others are engaging even in an eco-type of terrorism whereby they can alter climate, set off earthquakes and volcanoes remotely through the use of electromagnetic," unquote. Now, doesn't that sound interesting? And this gets, you know, back to where you and I first met, was this idea of, could you trigger earthquake with a system such as HAARP in the worst-case scenario? Could you trigger, could you create shunts of energy that would pull energy right out of the ionosphere down to the Earth? I mean, the idea of manipulating entire geophysical systems, whether it be for climate, volcanic eruptions, tidal waves, or earthquakes, those things... Our last secure defense while he was in office was suggesting terrorist organizations could do, unsophisticated scientifically by far compared to the U.S. and yet capable, which means the principles have to be much more simple than we're led to believe.
Yes, and all you really need is power and the lack of fear to be able to trigger the most devastating collateral damage you can imagine, and that's what we're going to talk about in this final hour. There is a significant amount of collateral damage that occurs with this electromagnetic and sonic warfare weapons and sensing systems that we're using on the planet right now. We have talked about beneficial effects. We've talked about reducing by 80% the amount of Ritalin used in a test population of hyperactive children by using properly biofeedback, brain biofeedback, where the children actually are empowered to manipulate their own brain chemistry with their own willpower using these feedback systems. And we've also talked about the malevolent manipulation of those wavelengths and brain chemistries and how it can be used as a weapon or as brain entrainment control, where people's emotions, their emotional state, even placing messages or images with color and smell and sound in a person's brain from a distance using these kinds of broadcast methods. And there is collateral damage that we're going to talk about in the final hour. I did want to give you a chance to tell our audience where you're going to be appearing for the next month or so.
Well, actually, most of my work for the next month will be in Alaska. On the website at earthpulse.com, we've got a cruise actually in May that we're going to be on from Seattle to Sitka, and talking not just about these issues but also some of the Alaskan history and cultural issues. We'll also be lecturing in LA in February for the Consciousness Expo. That's going to be a big event. We'll be doing a workshop also on sort of the right uses of these technologies. We'll be demonstrating a number of things that we've shown on the DVD on mind control technologies during the course of that workshop. So that's on the website. And people can also reach us in the United States toll-free at 888-690-1277.
Very good. And, of course, you can call in anytime during the live broadcast tonight at 888-268-4313. You regular BBS radio listeners know this phone number. Those of you that are listening to this as an archive won't be able to call that number and get this broadcast, but we do encourage you to listen to this broadcast repeatedly. There's a ton of information in it, and when you listen to it, make sure to tell a friend, because they need to visit these websites. They need to get this information in their hands so they, too, can become empowered. I also would like to very much welcome our new listeners, because this is a new time slot for X Squared Radio. Previously, we were on Wednesday nights from 10 to 11 Eastern Standard Time, and now we are on 4 to 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, or 3 to 6 Central Standard Time. I think Alaska's, what, 4 hours behind us?
Yes, that's right, yeah. So we're a little bit earlier in the day, and not quite at sunset yet here.
Well, the stars are out full force right now. Mars is a beautiful red jewel straight over my house at the moment.
All right.
And in this next hour, we are going to talk about collateral damage from the use of electromagnetic radiation in weapon systems, in sensing systems. Also, sonic radiation, sound waves that are used as sensing devices and weapons. And I think you'll... This is the part of the show you might want to have your young children turn away from. It's pretty audiographic in the sense that we're going to talk about death and mayhem, and so you might want to turn away. On the other hand, if you're interested in the collateral damage that can occur around systems that you once thought benign, and if you thought that weapons that are routinely shown on science fiction shows like Star Trek are impossible, you need to listen to this next hour, because I think you will be absolutely not only amazed, but I think you'll be shocked at what the capabilities are at this time. I don't think you'll see them live on CNN either, but nevertheless, they are out there. So we will take about a 1 minute break, listen to a little Cell Dweller, and if you like the bumper music, be sure to visit their website and buy Mr. Clayton's album, Cell Dweller, and we'll take a break right now. Positive. My guest tonight is Dr. Nick Begich, author of three books, co-author of one, Angels Don't Play This Harp. He co-authored that with Gene Manning. And we have Earth Rising, The Revolution, Toward a Thousand Years of Peace. And his third book is Earth Rising 2, The Betrayal of Science, Society, and the Soul. And he's also got two DVDs. Actually, there's four DVDs. Two of them have a lot of slides of some various biofeedback and I'm going to call it electromagnetic acupuncture instruments that you can use to enhance your ability to handle stress and improve your ability to learn and maybe help you become more at peace with yourself and others around you. And the other two are... I'm going to call them full-length lectures that are extremely informative, very, very well done, about various weapon systems, various effects of these weapon systems, and one of the things that we're going to talk about is right now the collateral damage of the use of some of these sensing systems and weapon systems. And you can call in during this live portion for the next hour at 888-268-4313 and ask our guest any question you like related to the material. Well, as I was reading your third book, which is the Earth Rising 2, The Betrayal of Science, Society, and the Soul, I have to admit I was brought to tears a few times because it's very powerful, the information that you give in there, not just the unfortunate and mysterious demise of your father and Mr. Boggs, Honorable Majority Leader in the House of Representatives, but also about the collateral damage that not just humans, we're talking about mammalian destruction, and it's almost like sonic torture. And we're going to go into a little bit of the details on this relative to animals that have been sort of caught in the crossfire of some of these weapons and unfortunately do not have representatives or animal scientists to come forward and say these things are affecting us in a very powerful way.
What we're talking about is the low-frequency underwater sonars that have been advanced in recent years by the United States Navy and others. And what they've done is there have been a number of scientists that have at least come forward and tried to stop the activity. And here's what happens with sound. First of all, it behaves much differently in water than it does in air. You know, when sound, like people are hearing our voice today, strikes their body, 99.97% of the energy in that sound is reflected away. A very, very small amount is actually absorbed into tissue. If you look at sound's behavior in ocean water, it's much different. In fact, the way marine mammals communicate with low-frequency sounds over huge distances, in some cases even thousands of miles and many hundreds of miles, is through low-frequency sound signals that get trapped based on temperature differentials and salt level differentials with depth in the sea. There's an area where these sound waves will get trapped and they'll bounce literally all the way to the other side of the sea so animals can hear these signals. What happens, though, is if you increase, which, you know, man has this propensity for deciding, well, if you can do it with a feather, let's try a hammer. You know? So, and we try and duplicate nature, which I think is a good thing. It's part of our creative impulse to try and duplicate nature. We just need to be a little more careful when we have also the ability to impact nature in a bad way. And in this case, what happened is sound waves, when they travel through the oceans, when they hit tissue, like our bodies, and that energy, instead of 99.97% of the energy being bounced away, 100% of that energy is absorbed into the tissue virtually, passes through the tissue until it hits a cavity like your lungs or air passages, where the energy is released dramatically and destructively, causing hemorrhaging or bleeding, the same kind of symptoms as you would get if you surfaced to the surface of the ocean too fast and you had the bends, as an example, could happen from the same situation. So what occurs also is the volume is extremely high. What they've been doing is testing this underwater sonars at 1/5,000th of what the eventual deployment would be. In other words, at just a fraction of the energy, and they experienced multi-species beachings that they eventually acknowledged in the Bahamas and other beaching incidents around the world. The problem is that every species, just about in terms of fish species within the seas that have a digestive tract, get gases within that digestive tract that become also susceptible to this kind of energy. So you could affect, by exploding digestive tracts and many, many species of fish across the oceans, you have just impacted dramatically the primary protein supply for most of the planet's people. So, you know, when you start talking about these types of technologies being deployed within the oceans without full consideration to their bio-effects, we are literally endangering a major portion of life within the seas.
So we're talking about a sonar system, sort of a sonar imaging system that's by the Navy known as CERTAS-LFA.
Right.
And it it tries to use frequencies between 100 and say 500 hertz. Now, for those of you that don't really know what that means, if you've ever been to a car show, and at the car show you will have some vehicles that have sound systems in them, and I'm not talking about ordinary sound systems. I'm talking with several thousand watts, and they put a microphone inside the car, close the car doors, and then with a remote control, turn the stereo up as loud as it will go and compete to see who can deliver the most sound pressure inside their vehicle. It's pretty entertaining if you go to them. I've actually seen license plates vibrate completely off the car before. But I'll give you a sample. The reason that they use a remote control is because if you were sitting in the car turning your stereo up to that level, it would either make you go deaf or it would cause extreme discomfort. And if you listen to it over a prolonged period of time, it could actually enlarge your heart or cause organ failure. This is the kind of sound pressure that can be generated by these subwoofers in these cars, and this is about the sound range that they're in, around the 100 hertz range. Well, we're talking about 150 to 155 decibels in these cars. Under the sea, the Certas LFA, and as Dr. Begich just said, we're talking about 100% transfer to tissue underneath the water. What is the decibel level that they run the Certas at?
You know, it was over 200, it seems to me. Let me go back to my notes on that. 240 was the maximum, I believe, decibel level.
240 decibels is equivalent to what, underwater dynamite?
Probably, except you've got to remember again, it's not just an incoherent signal, it's a coherent rhythmic signal, which again, depending on what frequencies it traverses, determines what kind of interactions it might have, as well as just the gross energy exchange that takes place. So, you know, when you're talking about a system like this, which they envision to be deployed in 80% of the world's oceans, you know, this is significant impact. And yet, what's happened in the interim is there was actually a lawsuit filed, and at least initially one, that said this, and this is where the solution really isn't one at all. It said that they would only use this device or these technologies in Southeast Asia and during wartime. Well, according to this administration, you know, that is what time it is.
And yeah.
You can't isolate this to one side of the ocean without it affecting the other, just because of the nature of what it is. You know, it's designed to transit the oceans easily and efficiently. The thing about it is, and it's to guard against, you know, those submarines that can get close in and have some method of detection. We all understand that. But, again, we need a discussion of what are the risks and are there other technologies that could accomplish the same thing, which there are.
Sure. There are what we term as passive systems. These are systems that just listen.
Right. You know, and with the, you know, with the advent of the silent submarines, of course, that, you know, we have to have some method to get past that. And, you know, I think we do have imaging technologies that have evolved and are evolving that the money could be equally spent on, and we could solve the problem without risking the seas. And it's not just risking the seas. You risk a major source of protein production on the planet, which means you put pressure on every other types of protein on the planet. And, you know, food shortages and food distribution problems are bad enough. The sea is responsible for a huge, huge amount of food production. It's absolutely vital. When we start messing with systems that are affecting the food chain in ways that dramatically affect human populations, then it's time for us all to be a bit more concerned. And these aren't right or left issues. These are basic principles, human issues based upon most people's view of stewardship over this planet, which I think humans are called to take some responsibility over.
Yes, I think that's true. I'm going to quote in your book on page 33 on Earth Rising 2. It says, "The most significant problem is lack of the Navy's willingness to review current scientific literature, initiate relevant independent studies, and evaluate the experimental evidence of the risks in an honest way."
Well, and this is, again, part of the problem is, you know, the drive here's what you have in military planners, and I don't fault them for being this way. It's their nature. It's why they're there. They plan for the worst case scenario, and they live in this kind of paranoid sort of world that the worst case scenario is going to happen, and so they design systems to guard against that. And what doesn't happen is it doesn't necessarily take a look at all of the other trade-offs involved. You know, when this type of sonar was first posed in the 50s, the Russians, the Soviets at the time, and the United States and others, we all agreed that this would have been a stupid race to engage in the seas, and so we didn't do it. You know, now they're resurrecting all this technology to become even more refined, and the temptation to do it is outweighing the good sense to refrain. And this often happens with over-energetic scientists that aren't considering all of its impacts. And, you know, this came out when the HARP issue was being contested by us, and Dr. Eastland, the inventor of that system, has, as he's watched what we've done, has come out and said to other scientists, hey, don't, object to your opposition. You know, listen to what they're saying. Consider the other disciplines that might be involved. And then maybe there's a different approach to science that sane people will take. And I think that, that really is what it's about. There's too much over-specialization without enough consideration to the other impacts of good science in one field may not be so good in another.
Well, is it pretty safe to say, though, that when we see a trail of dead whales on the beach, that these sonic sensing systems have been turned up to these levels and caused either disorientation, where they're actually using sound to locate their own young or navigate the oceans or arrange a rendezvous from thousands of miles away, or whether actual, physical damage has been done. Hasn't there been some necropsies done on these whales?
Yes, by Harvard University, as a matter of fact. In fact, a zoologist at the time on the beach in the Bahamas when the beachings occurred was able to immediately get those heads up to heads and lungs and the rest of the material up to the Harvard Medical School, where they were able to look at what was going on. And what they determined was that massive hemorrhaging had occurred. You know, literally, it would be like sticking a megaphone next to someone's ear and blasting it. You know, you're going to get serious damage, and that's exactly what happened. They were, and the other part is those that didn't beach. I mean, most sea life is away from the beach, for goodness sake. You know, they don't make it to a beach. You know, they're done. And yet, what happens if they go deaf? They can't forage for food. They can't communicate with their young, their mates. You have immediate impact. Human beings in the water are susceptible to the same kind of impacts when these systems are deployed. You know, the potential risks on sea life is there. Marine mammals are the first impacted, and mammals generally within the water, because of our lung cavities and gases within the bodies, cavities within the body, whereas many other species of sea life, to a lesser degree, are also affected, and this is where the danger lies, and there's no regulation.
Well, isn't there an environmental impact statement or something that has to be adhered to or researched before they deploy this?
Well, in this case, they had it under deployment for about 10 years experimentally, and then it was an environmental organization that raised the issue, where's the impact statement? There wasn't one. Forced them to one, and then this is where the big dispute in the science came out. In fact, it was back a number of years ago, we were asked to attend, I think it was the University of the Atlantic in Bar Harbor, Maine, and it was a commissioner's Marine Mammal Commission that configured a bunch of folks in this area to come forward, acoustical engineers and scientists involved in the underwater sonars, as well as environmental organizations. And I was asked to attend and present on the other electromagnetic weapons technologies being evolved to kind of get some of these organizations apprised that there's other risks besides just the one. But I met all these folks, which was tremendously useful, and we were able to put together the chapter in Earth Rising 2 based on what we had learned in that conference. And, you know, the military eventually assumed responsibility but really didn't do anything to change it. And even though these environmental impact statements are filed, the biggest polluters on record in the United States are, in fact, the military. I mean, if you look at all of the sites and all of the different kinds of ways you can destroy the place, they've got the best record for doing it. When you look at environmental impact statements, oftentimes they meet whatever minimum requirements are there, and they really don't go beyond them. And they employ those scientists that are most likely to give them the results they want. And that's
well, there you go. So the military's become the gatekeepers of science, and they have scientists that are bought into their way of thinking.
Right, like, you know, the electromagnetic exposures in the United States at the end of the Cold War, in the Soviet Union, the standards were 1,000 times more stringent than they are in the United States at that time. You know, and people go, well, what was that about? Well, it was about the fact that they understood the underlying biological mechanisms and applied them to their regulatory bodies. Now, whether they actually considered it, you know, I mean, if they had to develop a weapon system and it was going to override some of their own thresholds, you know, they didn't have anybody who was going to stop them.
Right.
They didn't say anything. But at least they understood it and they weren't afraid to acknowledge it. In the United States, if we acknowledge the same level of standards, so much of what we have around us would create such a huge liability that there would be nothing but lawsuits from here until eternity. And I think that's, again, the wrong thing to drive good decision-making. We just
I think so, too.
Along the way, people didn't know it before. They shouldn't be held liable for what they didn't know. The tobacco industry was a different story. They did know. They got held liable, and then they, you know, had to come out with all their data and make a settlement. Well, that's different. You know, that's where, again, this whistleblower mechanism of when people know the science is showing, and then there's private companies or government organizations withholding that information, that's fundamentally wrong. And the fact of the matter is, there are certain things that people are entitled to know, particularly those things that affect our individual health.
Well, that's it. I mean, there are trade-offs to security, and our founding fathers knew this very well and said that, you know, you don't want to trade liberty for freedom. You don't want to give up the right to protect yourself from government intrusion, or let's not even call it government, because what we're talking about here is the bureaucratic sub-government, not
right.
The government that you see on C-SPAN. These
right.
You will never see in public.
Right. You know, it's you know, and kind of if you watch, I mean, the way we've researched a lot of our material, if you look at the academic studies that kind of stimulate the interest, you look at the companies that end up with intellectual property rights, and then you look at the RFPs, the request for proposals that the military issues out when they find something real interesting. And then you see who wins them, and then you look back on, you know, corporate records and patent records, and then you start cross-referencing the scientists and their programs and projects. And all of a sudden you see a lot different picture than the one that comes out in the press release. And that's, you know, that's been the hallmark of our work. You know, we were supported in the last couple of years by the Lay Institute on Technology, and we're setting up a site that's going to take every one of the citations that we reference in our book and not just give the bibliography, but an extended abstract and make them searchable so they can be used by researchers around the world. And we're adding 700 into that site. It'll be the layinstitute.org site. And then we're adding another 1,000 documents later in the month, and eventually it will hold our whole archive, which is about 20,000 records at this point.
Wow, that is a great plan.
Well, and it's
information,
you know,
is power. Knowledge is power.
And we couldn't fund it on our own. You know, it took Dorothy Lay, one of the heirs to Herman Lay, who founded Lay Potato Chips, merged it with Frito and later PepsiCo. She saw the need for education in technology areas being put out there in a way which would really empower people to better understand sort of the impacts from an educational perspective. And so we have begun to set this site up, and in fact, in the next week, you'll see the first data load go in. We'll have a lot of information there for researchers, because we know when information is available to researchers, people will come up with much different things than what perhaps we've come up with. But these are within documents and things within our subject areas, which include the applications of technology, some things on climate change, things that we're interested in as an institute, but at the same time, giving other researchers access without having to dig for the years in which it takes to normally compile that kind of archive.
I think that's a wonderful effort. You know, what we're doing here and what we have done separately in our own ways is we're not trying to hamper the creativity of human researchers, because we know that the technology is going to explode, and we're going to talk about a couple other aspects of it, nanotechnology and even wireless technology here in just a second, but we want to be able to put research that has been done of collateral effects before these things become as popular, say, as the cell phone.
Right.
It would be just impossible to I don't care what news show you went on, if you told everybody, okay, everyone under the age of 25, you cannot use cell phones anymore until these things have been modified. That's not going to happen.
It's right. Too
late for cell phones.
That's right. It's the breeding ground for third-party litigation down the road.
Yes.
But Swiss Reinsurance, actually, which is one of the big advisors to the insurance industry globally, issued a report on electrosmog where they suggest that underwriters don't underwrite the risks of cell phones because they see it as potentially resulting in billions and billions of dollars in lawsuits down the road. And even Lloyd's of London won't underwrite the risks, as we understand it, of cell phones because of the potentials and because of what the research is already showing. Industry is reluctant to embrace that, especially in multi-billion-dollar industries, yet there are studies involving as many as 15,000 people in Europe showing the health effects of cell phone radiation. And precautionary principles are being applied in Europe where children are being advised and parents are being advised not to allow young children to utilize cell phones because of PACT is even greater on children.
Well, I know that a lot of our audience may suspect that it's not good to hold an electromagnetic transmitter up against your head for hours and hours a day.
That's right.
I myself have spent several thousand hours on cell phones, but years ago I went to a hands-free device, and I did not go to the kind that plugs into the ear, and I do not, when I'm on the cell phone, I don't keep my cell phone in my pocket or on my belt. I put it on the table or I put it on the armrest of the car away from myself so that I keep my exposure to a minimum.
Right, and this is, as busy as I am, it's a device that I've still managed to do without. When I look at technology, you're not going to get rid of cell phones by any means, but the industry can do a lot to address the energy densities and concentrations coming off of the antennas and the way the circuits are designed and the way they use their energy in the first place. So I think time will sort some of this out. Unfortunately, again, the reason it happens is because technology accelerates so fast now. We really don't have the chance to kind of go backwards and look at it, but again, cell phone, the energy densities and the types of G coming off of cell phones were studied in the 60s before cell phones were invented at the University of Washington for the Navy, and found that in 5 out of 6 studies they created deformation in chick embryos. The scientists that had done that work when cell phones came out said, hey, wait a minute, we analyzed all this years ago and we know there's going to be health consequences. And yet he was ignored, as were others. Eventually, Motorola, at the insistence of Congress, funded a $25 million study, hired a guy named Dr. George Carlo to do it.
Yeah, the Koch Institute.
Yeah, but George Carlo, I got to say, the guy is one of my heroes, because when he got all done and he issued his findings, Motorola went out and along with everybody else said, oh, it's all wonderful, everything's safe. And instead, he published a book called Cell Phones, Invisible Hazards in a Wireless Age, where he explains what he believes are the mechanisms for causing the negative health effects that the industry wanted to ignore. And it's, he was paid $25 million, his organization, to put that study together. And at the end, he didn't sing the party line. He gave the information, as a scientist did, and said, hey, we got risks here that we identified, and they need to be explored, and they need to be looked at further. And yet, the industry is not doing a thing at this point to follow up on that.
Well, that's pretty much true. Everywhere I go, I see people with a cell phone plastered against their head. Now, to some people's credit, I do see a lot of people using hands-free devices, and they are shielded wire, so they don't transmit the radio wave, the radio signal up into the head, and they hold the cell phone out in front of them.
So
at least some people are listening.
Yeah, and it's a simple solution. Still gives you full access without the risk, so why not? Half your conversation is not private anyway, so what if the other half isn't,
Right.
The conversation shouldn't be having them on a cell phone in public in the first place.
Well, that's exactly right. And it sort of, brings us to the next level here. We were talking about cell phones, and we're talking about Almost all the cell phones that are used now are all digital, which makes the information that's being transmitted across them that much easier to track and to control.
Yeah, yeah. And easy to intercept, easy to store. You're very efficient for everyone that wants to look in. And
yes, we only have to remember poor Newt Gingrich down there in Florida minding his own business, talking about his pack on his cell phone, and of course, completely innocent and having nothing to do with, as the press would have you to believe. I've got my tongue firmly in my cheek here. He was being surveilled by a couple who was following him in their car, and they tapped into the cell phone conversation, recorded it, copied it to cassette tape, and turned it over. And so Newt Gingrich was no longer the majority leader just because his cell phone was illegally tapped and illegally publicized.
Well, here's the other side of that. You know, they have built in as a requirement now for our own safety GPS, where they can locate you quickly in case you dial 911 and then don't talk anymore.
Yes. If you have an older version phone, it doesn't have the GPS chip in them, but I think just about any phone built in the last year has got GPS capability.
It's required, actually. It's a federal requirement now that it have it in.
Oh, my goodness.
All the new ones do. The first thing Osama bin Laden did is dump the cell phones and all the electronics. Because
I wonder why.
They always leave that unique signature. That tells you, that there's a message being transmitted or there's something being transmitted. Things that can be easily detected with the kinds of surveillance technologies we have, particularly when you're in places that are technically kind of silent. You know, when you look at Afghanistan or the Pakistani border as examples, you can isolate transmissions fairly readily in a place like that. Well, you dump the electronics and you're riding around on a horse, you're pretty difficult to detect. It's our technology that makes us not only able to be seen, but also able to hear. So it cuts both ways. Cell phones, are used routinely now in criminal investigations as a way to track people's movements. Anytime the phone is on, and you can really basically track a person's movement. Under some of the regulations that have been passed, Patriot Act and others, the ability to bypass the normal protections are gone. And so things, that's again one of those trade-offs that, although the government passed the original bill overwhelmingly, hundreds of local governments objected, and they didn't do a thing to change it. Even this last revisions to the bill that are being hashed out and finalized now aren't really still are too big of a trade-off for many of us.
Well, sure. I mean, I guess the area of data valence, this use of what we call telematics by the police or the government to pick up people with, say, an Arab accent talking on a cell phone,
right,
where they can track them and monitor their telephone phone calls. For now, we say, gee, that's a good thing. We want to keep ourselves safe, and we want to practice preemptive police. We want to catch a suicide or a homicide bomber before the homicide occurs. Then you're going to have these kinds of surveillance techniques, and they're being well funded, and they're being well researched, and I'm sure even on the news we don't see, because they have this, I guess it's popularly been called deniable or plausible deniability, but
we can still lie and not get caught is what they're really saying.
Yes, there's no official existence of this press in place unless you happen to be one of those prosecuted by this evidence. You'll probably never know that it exists. But where the groundwork and the mechanism, as I stated before, we're not very good at laying down technology once we learn how to do it. Once the wrong people get in power, then they use this information to surveil those that would unseat them.
Yep.
Or, in our case, would expose their antics to the public.
Well, and I think that's true, and I think the situation is always. There was a book written called Between Two Ages by Zbigniew Brzezinski back in the early 70s when he was at Columbia University before he became National Security Advisor to President Carter, and it was this sort of forecast of what was going to happen with technology and how dramatically it was going to change socioeconomic systems around the world and how technology would be applied. And actually, if you read it today, you'd swear it was a history of what in fact did happen over the last 33 years. And one of the things he said about technology was, you know, he talked about technology that you could influence human behavior with, and what he said is no matter who is in power, and I'm kind of paraphrasing now, but what he said was, no matter who is in power, liberal or conservative, the temptation to use that type of technology to further their political ends would be much greater than their good sense, the good sense to restrain.
Yes, pretty high.
Yeah, and, you know, here's the thing is people who get in office are very committed to their ideology. They don't say these things because they don't believe them. Quite the contrary. They believe what they say, and they've got whatever fact patterns have built them into that belief system. The fact is they want everyone else to believe the same way they do, whether they're a liberal or a conservative. And as a consequence, the use or the temptation to use technology to further whatever their political cause is, I think people can readily see where the problem is. And again, you know, what was the whole position in the very beginning of this country was about an open, transparent government that lifted people up and served people, not the other way around. Now we
sure, let the sun shine in.
Yeah, now we have the opposite. We have an opaque government, a transparent population, and that is where the danger is. The opposite has now occurred over a 200-year period. We have flipped it upside down and done just the opposite and have created the kind of government that lends itself to tyranny as opposed to the kind of government that lends itself to service. And that's where we're seeing this mean-spirited, you know, kind of government emerge. I mean, the latest thing is now, you know, the latest thing with this government has been not only is your Social Security in danger, but every pension you ever thought you had might not be there anymore. You know, that
yeah.
kind of approach to government, at the same time we wrote off $1 trillion to an S&L scandal, the biggest bank robbery in the history of the United States, and very few people went to jail for it.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, and so when you start to look at now again, you got $400 billion being spent on a world war in Iraq, and you know, many of us have the opinion that if we believe we wage war on someone and we go over there and we have the cause to do it, a lot of us don't believe we ought to stick around and clean the place up. You know, if we feel the need to go over and blow someone up, end it when the national leader is captured. It takes 12 weeks to train an American serviceman to go over there and fight that war. We've been there 2 years. We ought to be able to train an army in 2 years to get out of there. And these are issues that are being debated for all different political reasons, but I look at it from this perspective. If an 18-year-old American can be trained in 10 to 12 weeks to risk their lives for a cause in the Middle East, the Middle Easterners ought to be able to be trained in 2 years to represent their own cause in their own country.
Yes, and I guess the good thing about it is we do see a work in progress. Here we are 2 years later, they've got a constitution, they're going to have elections shortly.
Yep.
All this is good movement in the right direction.
That's right. That's right. And ultimately, you know, we give their country back to them and we leave.
Yeah, exactly.
In the interim, we have spent $400 billion and maybe more by the time it's done to accomplish that. You know, I mean, we really need to analyze how money goes. You know, warfare is where all this starts in the discussions. And giving all due respect to our servicemen and women who are at risk right now, we need to stand up for them as long as they're in harm's way. But when we look at the whole picture, in the future, we need to not rush to war or use preemptive war as a strategy, but take a look at how those billions could better be spent to avoid war in the first place. And that's solving the big problems that bring us into places like the Middle East. The technical problems and obstacles we have to overcome can be overcome to change the need to be fighting over oil, which ultimately is what all this is about.
Yes, and that's generally where this whole metamorphosis needs to go, is that sooner rather than later, and I think, you know, many of the listeners of this program and many of the people that you meet with, we understand that by and large we're earthlings. We're not wanting to stake a claim on a piece of dirt and say you can't come here or you can't have that, but it's much more than that. There is a way of distributing energy and information and clean water in this world where everyone can have some.
Yeah.
And
here's a good example, Brooks. You know, energy distribution, you know, the big problem, as many know, is line loss over transmission lines, right?
Right.
Well, what is superconductivity going to do to that?
It'll fix that problem.
Yeah, but then you think about this. Geothermal energy on the Aleutian chain alone has enough energy in it to run all the electric in the world. Just that. you know,
right.
And it runs for tens of thousands, millions of years, geothermal energy.
Oh, but it's clean.
Yeah, and you know, and already the technologies exist. Iceland has geothermal. In fact, they run their buses by taking their excess geothermal that generates electricity, use it to create hydrogen, and run their transit system on hydrogen all day long.
You know, exactly.
We are so close that if we applied that same $400 billion, we could have created the beginnings of a dynamic hydrogen economy that took us out of the need to be in the Middle East in the first place.
And that's not to say that the Middle East would then be plunged into poverty, and that the oil companies and all of the employment that they produce around the world would be plunged into poverty.
No.
Quite the opposite.
No, it would be, because you still have to utilize all these oil-burning systems while you're transitioning. But, you know, think about this. The oil companies have amassed the biggest chunk of capital in the history of the world because of oil prices that they apply to those alternatives as well, and it's in their own self-interest to do it, and some of them are, on the basis that they know they're coming anyway. So, you know, we're in a transition stage. This generation, in terms of the big problems, we have the opportunity to apply, instead of this sense of overt paranoia and threats that aren't necessarily there, take a look at the threats that are there that we can solve technically, and we could overcome many, many of the problems we're facing now. But it takes that change in direction and the right application of technology, and that means that within governments like ours, the average person has to have at least a conceptual understanding of technology so the right political debates happen. We're just not used to debating technology as an issue as Americans, or anyone, anywhere in the world. That's just not, we're used to debating all these other things, but technology, when you look around us, really does dictate many of those other things.
Sure it does. Sure it does. And what we want to see is that the most impoverished corners of the planet are provided the opportunity of access to the very most basic energy and clean water and health needs that are available. And if we took, as you said, if we could get to the point where we did not fight amongst ourselves, and I think that's going to be difficult to do when
sure,
there is a faction of the planet that wants everyone else except their religion to die.
Yeah.
We get into a whole different discussion there. But as far as the economic atmosphere, the environment that we could create by redirecting our warfare dollars and turn it into almost geoformation instead of that, we could not only save the planet, we could save the race.
Yeah,
and we have the power at our fingertips to do it. Maybe 15 years ago, we could not have done it. The computer speeds were not fast enough to process the information to do what we need to do, but computer speed is going to change. We think we have fast computers now. The nanotechnology, my brother is a chairman of physiology at Johns Hopkins. Don't want to put a plug in for them, but I do want to say that he has a floor of his building that's dedicated to nanotechnology and drug research, and they are going to make tremendous inroads. We've stated on this program before that I believe in the next 20 years, every major disease will be cured. I'm not talking about every form of cancer, but certainly diabetes, cystic fibrosis. We will cure our first virus within 5 years. I'm confident of it. Because we're able to design mechanically enzymes and combinations of proteins that are needed to target drugs better now than we ever could do it. But the limit has been the computing power. Now, see, the computer I'm using right now, I think, is a 2-gig machine. This is nothing. We are so entrained in binary logic that we think this is the limit. I mean,
about
as fast as we can go.
But
very soon, trinary and even quaternary logic will come, and this will be molecule-sized switching.
Yep.
We will not have silicon chips anymore. These will actually almost be like organic computers.
Right. And now we're talking about storage densities that are just unbelievable. That means that nobody will throw out any information because there won't be any reason to. It'll be just too cheap to store. You know,
right.
Better to keep it.
Right.
And when you think about the interconnectivity of information, as that continues to grow, eventually, I mean, it's almost like the every mind and every bit of information can be linked and accessed almost instantaneously at that point. The possibilities are just fantastic. I mean,
sure.
It makes the transition between the 1880s and today will look like nothing compared to what we're about to see happen.
Well, just look at the world in the last 9 years. Really, the Internet has been around, effectively around, for 9 years.
Yeah.
Somewhere around 1996 is when people began to buy PCs, personal computers, on a global basis.
Right.
Well, in the next 9 years, what is going to happen is the lock, the monopoly that universities have had on knowledge is going to go away. And it's going to be available to every smart person that wants to learn.
And the beauty of it is...
Yes, and when you do that, now you've got people that have a foundation knowledge. They learn all available math, and then they reach out into new math, and they make that available to people.
Yep. And it's, you know, and the thing it does is open the door for everyone. You know, the best inventions that were ever made that affect us every day were made by non-scientists. From a couple of bicycle makers inventing the airplane to the small microcomputers invented in garages by hobbyists. The reality is creativity is universal. If you have access to information on a universal level, then great things can be possible. And then this is where the underlying ethics and values that drive information have to be considered. And when you're talking about information being widely available, you have to start to think about downstream effects. Like, for instance, the idea of being able to transfer complete memory sets, as we had talked about a few hours back. You know, that idea, in terms of education applications, might be pretty exciting if you're going to learn something like mathematics or vocabulary, things that are value neutral. But what happens when you use those systems to study social sciences that aren't value neutral necessarily?
Yeah, rewritten.
Exactly. And this type of transfer of information, according to Smirnov and the Russian Academy of Sciences and many others, bypasses the conscious, the part that filters out right and wrong, good and evil, and drops that information in a long-term memory in a way that sort of bypasses all of that. So when you think of things transiting from military eventually into civilian hands, and then you think of education being compulsory in the United States up till the age 16 in most states, the fact is who decides the curriculum will have a lot greater effect, a much greater effect on value systems than ever before. And if they conflict, if what's put in conflicts with their person's value systems, for many forms of psychosis, that's the root, conflicts within value systems. And so, you know, how things evolve and how learning evolves when you start thinking about these technologies, and then computing power, you know, what they're shooting for is a literal download. You know, the brain can hold a lot of data if we could figure out how to model the system of input. You could do huge changes in what people store in their brains. And that's where military planners would like to go with some of this.
Yes, well, I think what I would like to do with my energy, my lifetime, my ability to communicate, my access that I have here through my world-class producer, is to try to notify people, to empower them so that they know that the military has this kind of ability. They are empowered with billions and billions of dollars. But ultimately, in this country at least, they have to answer to us. And we have to have a sense of responsibility and duty, not just to our country, to our race, to stand up and say, we are not going to have a military community on this planet like that anymore. We are not going to destroy each other. We're going to help each other.
And I think, you know, I think there's a lot of folks within the military establishment that believe that same way. You know, and I'm not an anti-military person. I believe in a strong defense. The world is volatile. We're going to have warfare for a long time in the future. But the point is, our technologies that remove us further and further from the battlefield where we can inflict significant harm and never have the scent of death in your nostrils, it has a huge impact on how easy it becomes to wage war. You know, our fathers or grandfathers returning from the wars of the past always had a deep commitment to avoid, as far as they could, wars in the future, you know, having experienced it. When you're not on the ground experiencing it the same way, I think we really change the dynamic. It becomes easier and easier to inflict pain if it doesn't inflict pain back on ourselves or bring back the memories, which is why media is so controlled in the current conflicts we're in. You see very few images coming out of Afghanistan at all, and very few that aren't absolutely piped in and controlled coming out of Iraq. And I think the realization of the average citizen in terms of what we're each responsible for by virtue of our government needs to be disclosed, understood for what it is, and avoided when it can be. And when it can't be, by all means, you know, we have to utilize our force when we need to. But, you know, the tendency with technology makes it easier. It's like non-lethal weapons. A guy's more likely to pull the trigger if they don't think they're going to kill someone. Yet many of these weapons do, in fact, kill people, whether
sure.
they're rubber bullets or gas.
Or tasers or pepper
right.
spray, and lots of
right.
people permanently blinded and killed by tasers
yep.
every day, and but they're still being used.
Yeah.
I guess
yep.
it's easier to pull that than it is your 9mm.
Well, and it is, because if you look at conflicts such as the things in Northern Ireland for years using non-lethals, periodically people would die from lung disorders related to asphyxiation with the gases or rubber bullets or what have you. Yet in Yugoslavia during one full year of conflict where everybody was holding lethal weapons, weapons that would kill, not a bullet got fired for a year because people knew they pulled the trigger, someone dies. Non-lethal weapons, people pull the trigger believing that no one will die when in fact people do. And when you start to look at warfare and why these systems are being pushed, is if you don't have that visual image, that detestable image of death, people may be more willing to engage in conflict. Non-lethal weapons, particularly, if you don't have a distaste from this war, is going to be in rebuilding. People are going to be sick of the fact that we spent hundreds of billions of dollars rebuilding a country, and when our government comes forward and says, hey, we've developed new systems where we can wipe out all the people and keep the buildings intact, there's going to be a lot more willingness to accept those types of energy weapons-based systems as opposed to the old bombs and bullets that tear tissue and buildings up.
Yes, that's one of the byproducts of this new technology is literally designer bioweapons.
Right.
Weapons
right.
that can actually pick up, well, they'll actually only affect people with a certain genetic marker.
Right. Certain races could be targeted. Certain people with certain disabilities could be targeted that show up in their genetic makeup. Only men could be targeted or only women. I mean, you could do all kinds of things once, and we can now, see, because we hold, this is, again, we hold the knowledge, now we have the responsibility to use it wisely. And that, within democracies and democratic republics, means that informed citizens have to insist that things are used wisely. And it's like the automobile. You know, most of us can't fix one these days because they're too complicated, but we can still drive it from place to place. In the same way, we need to drive our public policy as it relates to technology from place to place. Don't have to know how to build it. Don't have to have the same knowledge as a scientist. But we have the equal power of anyone in this country to make sure things are used to enforce democratic, basic democratic principles.
Well, that's the idea. We want to make sure that the technology that's being spread around the planet isn't misused, for one thing, but also so that the developers of the technology, the actual ones that are developing these weapon systems, whether they be sonar or whether they be HARP or whether they be other electromagnetic radiation weapons or communication systems, that they have some civilian oversight so that people can say, just a moment, do you realize what would happen if you hit this particular frequency firing your weapon in this particular manner?
Right.
As we discussed with HARP, forming a solar tap
right.
might be a backfire that they definitely do not expect, but they could expect it and they could avoid it if civilian researchers were allowed to at least contribute to these committees.
Right, and you know, here's another thing about HARP is, you know, is two of the ideas that Ben Eastland had about it were, one, that you could use it for creating chemical reactions in the upper atmosphere to replenish ozone, as an example. Or you could create chemical reactions to knock out very specific pollutants by using knowledge of resonant frequencies and ways to stimulate chemical reaction. And here's the sad story, is no one's even looking at that. If climate change is related to ozone depletion, as everyone claims, you know, this would be the best thing since sliced bread if we could figure out how to do that, you know, replenish ozone and solve that problem. Maybe it's not that problem. I kind of take the view that it may not be. It may be more than that. It probably is. But the reality is there are some really interesting concepts that should be explored, but because it is a military project and those are not military priorities, they get ignored.
Yes.
And that's a huge thing from my perspective. I mean, if you have something to solve, and this is where that international whistleblower mechanism, you got something that's going to solve that kind of problem, or somebody comes up with a superconductivity solution that's being withheld. I mean, these are things that are in humankind's interest to have solved in order for everyone on this planet to benefit and take the pressure off of the forces that work against the better nature of human beings. You know, it's food shortages, it's lack of certain resources that drive so much of warfare beyond just the ideological differences. You know, you start to solve basic human needs, and then a lot can be solved from there. And our science is capable of doing that. This planet is capable of supporting the number of people on it in a rational way, and it doesn't have to be the Western way. You know, leaving people alone sometimes within the context of their own culture is the higher value, not the other way.
Sure, sure. There's no need to invade or to change someone's value systems or to change their religion or you know, make them wear certain clothes or drive certain vehicles.
No.
You're exactly right. Sometimes just letting that people be that people, as long as they're not going out and being aggressive to other people on
right.
the planet, that's perfectly good. The American Indians or Eskimos or Aborigines, there's no sense going in there westernizing them. It won't solve a thing. But
no, in fact, I participated in an international conference on environment and poverty sponsored in Europe by the Patriarch of the Orthodox Church and Prince Philip, the Duke of Edinburgh, a number of years ago with a number of folks on this very issue. And what everyone was saying uniformly at that point was, you know, just because someone is poor economically from Western view doesn't mean that they're unhappy, you know. In fact, you go into other cultures, they are in fact rich in terms of their lifestyles, how they are, and yet we come in with this view, oh, you know, we see it from our own perspective. We bring them our version of prosperity, which usually leads to urbanization, which then detaches people from their roots, which makes it impossible for them to self-sustain, and they become dependent on the very systems that we thought were giving them independence, and we've taken it away from them. And what most are saying now in international development in terms of how we apply what we think is important is ask more questions and impose your own value systems and judgments a little bit slower, and you might actually result in enhancing what's already there rather than destroying it. And I think that's a shift that we need to take. When corporate interests, which look at people as consumers and as, you know, as something other than human beings, I think it drives the wrong outcomes. And that's what we've seen happen internationally. So we've looked at expanding markets when we really ought to be saying, you know, what is prudent and rational and what represents a good policy in terms of dealing with people, and ask it on a human level first, not a consumer level first.
I couldn't agree more. I could not agree more. Well, this has been an amazing 3 hours. I can't believe 3 hours has gone already.
We'll have to do it again.
Well, there's no doubt. And I want to improve our ability to work with one another. I did contact the Life Expo people in Los Angeles, and it appears as though they're open-minded to having me speak there in 2007. There are a lot of volunteer organizations that our listeners can get involved with their dollars, with their voices, with their letters, which can help, and we implore them to do that. And this this show will go on the archives of X Squared Radio. Will be visible by about 2 million people a day, 14 million people a week, and as we expand our venue, that is to say, rebroadcast on radio waves, either in Europe or in the United States. They'll be able to listen to this program as an archive. And we are pursuing digital radio and even content for additional television channels. So we are going to continue to get the word out. We are going to continue to educate and to enlighten people. I do want to thank with all of my heart Dr. Nick Begich, who has been here with us for 3 hours. It's been an amazing experience. I want you to go to his website, earthpulse.com. Check out his two books, Earth Rising, The Revolution, and Earth Rising 2, The Betrayal of Science, Society, and the Soul. And don't forget to pick up Angels Don't Play This Harp. It's also a national bestseller that he co-authored with Gene Manning. Remember who you are, Earth Explorers, and take care of yourselves. Be good to one another. And remember, if it's not mainstream, it's on BBS. I'm Brooks Agnew. Peace, Earth Explorers, and Merry Christmas. Good night.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a Service to Others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.